House Committee on Consumer Protection, Interim Committee on Consumer Protection to order this morning. I want to thank everybody for getting here on time. And this morning we're going to look at two topics. One of them is mortgage lending, and we're going to have an update from the mortgage lending work group. Following that, we will have some information presented to us on business entity regulation and some related fraud issues. As some of the committee knows, we've been dealing with mortgage lending from 2007. Some of you have been lucky enough to have been with this committee this long. It started out a pretty interesting topic and pretty came to us with a lot of concerns, what started out to be some lending practices that were ending up in foreclosures, and really wanting to look at those practices and try to stem the amount of foreclosures that possibly happened in Oregon. And of course, as everybody knows, that's sort of really grown to be a national issue, which has ended up in some issues with our credit markets and really had some major impacts. Certainly we only have the ability to, you know, enforce and regulate some aspects of that industry, not the entire industry. Much of it's regulated by the federal government. So, and this committee did pass on to the House which a bill restricting prepayment penalties, which I believe failed in the Senate, is my recollection, this last February. But since that time, the federal government has made some major adjustments to their Regulation Z and Truth in Lending Act to look at mortgage lending practices. And so this morning, we're going to hear from the Mortgage Lending Work Group, which was headed up by the Department of Consumer and Business Services, to look at these issues in the interim and see where the state of Oregon needs to look at their statutes and their ability to regulate this market. And so with no further ado, I think we'll bring up Corey Streisinger and David Tapman from the Department of Consumer and Business Services to give us an update on where the Governor's Mortgage Lending Work Group ended up and what they see coming forward for us for 2009.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me is David Tapman, Administrator of our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which regulates mortgage lending as well as many other financial institutions in the news these days. And we appreciate the opportunity to be here and give you an update on the Mortgage Lending Work Group. This group was convened initially at the request of the Governor about a year ago, in September 2007, to look at the mortgage lending industry and to make recommendations that would both assure that we can maintain a strong lending industry here in Oregon to allow people to borrow money to finance their homes, assuming that is that the national and international markets will allow that to happen, but also to ensure that mortgage lending provided loans that a borrower could be successful at paying back and could be successful at retaining their home. And the group came up with several proposals, which, as you've mentioned, Mr. Chair, came to this committee. This committee spent a lot of time in the February session, and the legislature passed proposals dealing with foreclosure rescue schemes, additional notices to assist people in avoiding foreclosure, as well as additional regulation of loan originators. Since the mortgage lending work group was convened, and even, of course, in recent weeks, there have been considerable changes in the lending industry, and including at the federal level, as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, that have addressed a number of the issues that the legislature also spent a lot of time discussing in the 2007 session as well as the February 2008 session. In just the past few months, we've seen the adoption of strong new rules by the Federal Reserve, amending Regulation Z of the Truth in Lending Act. And we have also seen the adoption of federal legislation making some amendments to the Truth in Lending Act, as well as putting new provisions in place. And then, of course, there have been changes through the government's takeover of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which may well affect underwriting standards in the future. And we do expect further rulemaking and guidance at the federal level on all of these changes. There are a number of tasks which are still underway. So the federal actions do a number of things addressing issues that this committee has spent time on in the past, including, for example, enhanced disclosures for mortgages generally, and specifically some enhanced disclosures for adjustable rate mortgages. There are new provisions in the federal legislation that passed, often referred to as the SAFE Act, and one of the attachments to my testimony is an excerpt from Title V of the SAFE Act, which shows the new disclosure requirements for adjustable rate mortgages that include disclosure of the maximum payment that could be based on the maximum interest rate. So that addresses one of the concerns about people knowing what payment they might need to make if they do enter into an adjustable rate mortgage. There are restrictions on misleading advertising in the new Federal Reserve regulations. We have also adopted new rules at the state level on misleading advertising. There are prohibitions on coercion of appraisers to misrepresent value, and there are restrictions on loan servicing abuses. There's then another set of practices restrictions which apply to a class of loans defined in the rule as higher-priced mortgages, which are essentially intended to capture the cluster of subprime mortgages. And if you look at a couple of the other attachments to my testimony, we gave you a fairly high-level summary of the new restrictions in the Federal Reserve rules, as well as the rules themselves from the Federal Register. So some of the limits on higher-priced mortgages include a limit on prepayment penalties, a prohibition on making these higher-priced loans without evaluating the borrower's ability to repay, and a requirement to verify income and assets on which the lender relies, all of which are probably familiar concepts to you from the legislation that's been under consideration in the past. So we're actually very encouraged by these new rules, which we believe provide substantial new protections for Oregon borrowers and have the advantage of applying across the board to all aspects of the mortgage lending industry, whether federal or state chartered. And we are quite sensitive to concerns expressed by the lending industry that these new changes are very substantial, that they will require shifts in business practices, they will take some time to absorb, and that imposing a whole new set of additional regulations at the state level would be an additional burden to absorb at this time. However, we also do believe there are some gaps in the federal legislation that really do need to be addressed at the state level. So in the work group, we have discussed a number of these issues, and we do intend to propose some additional legislation for your consideration in the 2009 session. We also believe that some of the issues that have been discussed by the work group and by this committee and by the legislature, some, as I said, are addressed by the federal legislation. Some, we believe, are actually already covered under existing law and could be fleshed out through rulemaking. So I should say that the work group did not reach consensus on this set of proposals. We were very, very appreciative for the many hours of work spent by all a wide variety of stakeholders to discuss these issues, to make sure that everybody understood the nuances of them. I think our recommendations have benefited greatly by that input, but I do not want to represent to you that these represent consensus agreement, because, in fact, it's quite likely that you will see a wide variety of different viewpoints expressed and have an opportunity to make decisions on those when we get into session. So with that, David's going to walk through where we landed as the department in the specific issues that the work group has been considering and that have been on the table. David?
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. David Tatman. As Ms. Reisinger said, I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and it's our agency that regulates mortgage brokers, bankers, loan originators, and a host of other financial services. As Ms. Reisinger said, this has been a long process that we had started in 2007, and after the special session in 2008, we then picked up some new concepts. And through the process of the work group, we had the opportunity to vet a number of different ideas, concepts, get input, and really help us hone where we think it's important to address issues and where we think maybe federal government has already addressed the issues or where maybe it's a matter of waiting a little bit longer. So this has been a very long process, very constructive process, and a lot of input, give and take. And I think this proves how productive these work sessions can be. And so I just want to echo what Corey said, that I'm very appreciative of everyone who participated in that, including you, Mr. Chair, and all the input that we've got. So you have a copy of our testimony, and in it you'll see highlighted or in bold different sections. So what I'm going to do is just walk through those different sections where it's bolded and just give you a very quick thumbnail sketch on whether we're doing something there or whether we've concluded that this is not the time to do something or there's not the need to do that. So with your indulgence, I'll just take you through starting on page 3. So on page 3, the first thing and probably the foremost thing we want to address is the new federal standards. And as Ms. Reisinger said, there have been a number of changes, both by rule and statute at the federal level, addressing mortgage lending. What we wanted to do was make clear that the state had the ability to enforce those new rules. We already have the ability to address some of the Truth in Lending activity in RESPA or the Real Estate Settlements Practices Act. But, as you know, when you codify something in time, it's frozen at that point. So our proposal is we want to be able to pick up this new version. So we're going to go forward and ask that we have the authority to do just that. It makes sense. We are the cop on the beat, if you will. The federal government doesn't have people in place to go in and do the examinations necessary and do the enforcement work necessary. So this would just be a continuation of our current powers. A licensure of loan originators. As you know, in 2008 at the special session, we addressed the issue of loan originators and we came up with a registry process. We thought that was a good middle ground. However, the federal government, through the SAFE Act, which was just passed this summer, said that they want every state to license all loan originators. And if the state doesn't act, that the Housing and Urban Development Agency will take that authority over. I think most of our licensees, and I think most people in general would say that's not the right direction to go, and in fact, the federal government doesn't want to do that. And so we will be coming forward with a bill to address the licensing of loan originators. What's interesting is it will be all loan originators. It won't be just loan originators and mortgage bankers and brokers. It will also be loan originators who make real estate loans on behalf of consumer finance companies who up until now have not been licensed. And we think that's helping to level the playing field, as we've heard many times, it has been very unlevel. And then the loan originators that work for banks and credit unions, while they won't be subject to our direct oversight, they will be also registering with this national system. So there will be a national database in place where people have to meet certain consistent standards across the United States. We think this is a great idea both for information, for consumers to have a full disclosure about who they're working with, but also to allow members of the industry to be able to get licensed in different states on a more regular and consistent basis. So it should expedite that process, too. So we think that's a positive win-win, and we'll be coming forward with a legislative concept in that area.
Mr. Tatman, can you clarify for me just for a minute so I understand? Now, is the state going to be licensing loan originators that work for federally chartered banks or federally chartered institutions, or are they just going to be registered at the federal level?
Mr. Chair, that'll be the latter. They will register at the federal level, but by registering, that information will be available to the public. They'll have a number assigned to them, and there'll be certain requirements that they have to provide information about their background and so forth. But it's just a registration for them because of the nature of the Congress saw a distinction between banks and credit unions versus consumer finance and mortgage lenders.
Thank you.
Another requirement that we're going to be addressing is the increase in surety bonds. State of Oregon already requires surety bonds for our our mortgage lenders. Candidly, that's something that we have picked up back in 1993. We may not have kept pace with cost of the, or the rising value or diminishment, I mean, of the dollar. So maybe time to look at it just from the actual dollar amount. But in addition, the new federal act says each licensed loan originator shall be covered by a surety bond. We think we can address that in an equitable way where we make sure that the company picks up the surety bond requirements, but that the surety bond would cover the acts of each loan originator. So we'll be addressing that. All those will be things we'll be putting forward in legislation. Some of the things that we'll be addressing, we think we can address apart from legislation, are areas that came up during the mortgage lending work group. Good faith and fair dealing. We think that's obviously the standard that all commercial enterprises should be operating under. And in fact, we believe that under common law, under general law, if you will, mortgage lenders are required to work with their clients with good faith and fair dealing. Now, there was some talk about trying to put that into the bill. We think we can address that by rule and describe what we think is good faith and fair dealing. There's some question about that, and you may hear different opinions on that, but we think we can address that issue by rule to say that people should be treated fairly.
Maybe I could just jump in and say there's also a statutory provision already in existence prohibiting unfair and unethical practice, and that would be the basis for the rulemaking. And we did attach to the testimony the excerpts from existing law.
We think that that is good faith and fair dealing is, if you will, an extrapolation of unfair and unethical practices, so we think we can address that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Corey and David, what is the penalty for someone that violates this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, there are two penalties. If you are licensed and you engage in unfair or unethical practices, you can lose your license, and that's the big penalty. There's also a provision where we can take administrative action and impose a $5,000 civil monetary penalty, a money penalty, per violation. So if you engage in unfair practices multiple times, then we can impose a $5,000 fine maximum per violation.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, there is also a private right of action already existing in law so that someone could hire a lawyer and bring a lawsuit if they believe that unfair practices and unethical conduct has taken place. And we're actually going to talk about that a little later as well.
Oh, okay. Good.
All right. Thank you. Regarding another issue that came up was this notion of having a side-by-side comparison. A lot of people think that makes sense for people who are going in and making the largest monetary decision, financial decision of their life that they'll make. And if they go in and refinance, it's helpful for them to understand the benefits and the terms that they're currently facing versus the potential benefits and terms of a new or refinanced loan. And there was a lot of discussion about creating such a form. We're mindful of the fact that additional forms are a challenge for the industry. We're thinking that this is something that we want to continue to look at. We know the federal government is also looking at that. And, in fact, Congress has mandated the Secretary of HUD, Housing and Urban Development, to take a look at coming up with some type of form. So rather than act now and potentially get ahead of the federal government, we think it'd be prudent to wait and see what comes out of that and then decide if we need to go forward with that concept. Again, as Ms. Streisinger said, we do have certain broad authorities to address issues of material disclosure, that is material misstatements of law or material omissions of law, and it's possible that failing to disclose what I would call less than beneficial aspects of a new loan versus the current benefits of an old loan may constitute a material omission under present law. So that's something we're also exploring. But I think this is one where we're going to wait and see where the feds come down before we move forward on the concept. The issue of negative amortizations, as Ms. Streisinger said, that's an area of the law where we think it is important for us to step in. Negative amortization loans are loans where people either at a set rate pay less than the principal and interest that's accrued by the loan over monthly payments, or have a period of time but where they can pay less. In other words, the principal actually grows rather than diminishes through their monthly payments. We think that those are particularly confusing for the consumer, and we think that's an area where we want to be very clear that consumers understand any impediments they may have. So there, we're going to come forward and address the issue of prepayment penalties. Some have called for the outright ban of negative amortization loans. We think that's maybe a step too far because there are probably situations where they are useful that may be rather limited, but we don't want to outright ban them. Rather, we want to address it and maybe put clear limitations on certain detriments that could pop in there. So we would be proposing to put in similar language on prepayment penalties such as the federal government has adopted for high-cost loans, so that you couldn't have a prepayment penalty more than 2 years. And if you issued the loan and then turn around and refinance the loan, you don't get to have the prepayment penalty exercised.
Before you move off that topic, if I could, we also would propose for negative amortization loans applying the same federal standard that they're now applying to higher-priced loans for ability to repay and verification of assets, so that before you could make a negative amortization loan, the lender would have to verify ability to repay under those same federal standards and document the assets and income.
So we want to make sure that, as you've heard, the low doc, no doc loans, or the liar loans, as some people call them, won't be available for negative amortization.
Thank you. Representative Galizio.
Thank you. Do you know why the federal government didn't ban prepayment penalties in the negative amortization loans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, if it was a high-cost loan, they put limitations on prepayment penalties, but they didn't ban them outright. I think, again, it was probably a balancing act, because I know there was discussion about eliminating prepayment penalties at the federal level, too, but that was a decision that the Federal Reserve Board made when going through their Truth in Lending Act. They've got a huge document that explains their thought process, and I couldn't begin to recreate that, but that's something that's probably available on the website if you'd like to follow that up or have us follow it up.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the issues that came up was the whole issue about fees, costs, and the yield spread premium. You're probably familiar with the concept of yield spread premium. That's where a mortgage lender may receive some form of compensation from the lender as opposed to the fee that comes from the borrower for making the loan. And there's a request that that information get disclosed. That certainly has been a very strongly discussed issue, and maybe it borders on emotional at times. And again, we thought at this point, the Federal Reserve Board didn't feel they could come up with a good way of resolving the problem. They looked at it long and hard, and as I say, there are multitude of pages in their report explaining their thinking on this, and they actually did, if you will, a focus group study on this, and they concluded they just couldn't come up with a workable way of addressing this issue. As such, we felt like it wasn't our place to maybe step up and do that at this time. So we're declining to pick up the yield spread premium. But again, that's one of those issues where I can imagine you'll have groups come forward and say maybe that should be disclosed. It's not a request for a ban, but just full disclosure. One of the areas we do want to pick up is the issue of disclosure to groups who are being selected for advertising or solicited for loans in languages other than English. As we know, that there are a number of groups in Oregon, predominantly Spanish-speaking, Russian-speaking, and Vietnamese-speaking, who receive advertisements and who, in fact, do business to some degree in other than English language. We feel like if the predominance in negotiations and discussions is in a second language, that certain fundamental disclosures should also be in those second languages. So we're proposing to come forward with authority to create at least the good faith estimate and the truth in lending disclosures in a second language. And it would be the three most widely used languages other than English, which, as I say, is Spanish, Russian, and Vietnamese. And our agency would agree to prepare the documentation necessary for that. In addition, we would ask in that second language that a disclosure be made that this is a very important matter, and that you, the consumer or borrower, should bring somebody who can translate for you to closing. What we think is it's just a prudent way to make sure people understand the full import of what they're getting into. So that's something we'll go forward with. And then the last piece that we intend to address legislatively is address the issue of the private right of action and attorney's fees. One of the things we'd like to do, we currently have that, as Ms. Streisinger pointed out, it's currently in the law, and we're not trying to change the private right of action. What we're saying is we think it is a prudent practice to provide a notice to the mortgage lender or bank if there's a problem, and give the bank an opportunity to respond to that rather than file a lawsuit and then have the bank have to address it legally. And the vehicle for doing that is we're proposing that a notice go out prior to a lawsuit. And if that notice goes out, there's either a presumption or a flat declaration, and that means it's a good faith lawsuit, that it was done in good faith, and therefore that the defendant may not be able to recover attorney's fees if the defense prevailed. We think that by doing just this, it will actually allow for both sides to reconcile matters before they get to the stage of filing the lawsuit and getting into the cost of litigation, and should solve perhaps a number of problems. So the notice would be filed, and if the person comes in the last day that they have for filing a lawsuit, that the statute of limitations is expiring the next day, by filing the notice, that would toll the statute of limitations, that is, hold it off for 20 days to allow for the other side to respond, and if the response is unsatisfactory, then they can file the lawsuit. So it's a minor modification to the private right of action that we heard from when talking with the various sides of the mortgage lending work group. The last thing I wanted to touch on is consumer financial education. I think that's probably the most critical thing that we as a society need to address. We don't have necessarily an answer for that right now. Every financial services industry that I've talked to, whether it's banks, credit unions, mortgage lending, securities brokers, or whatever, all say society would be better served if people understood better what they were getting into, what the limitations are, and what their rights are. So financial education or financial literacy is critical. And at this point, we are working with a number of groups, spearheaded by the Credit Union Association of Oregon, and I see Ms. Levitt's in the room. We'll be going forward in the next 2 months to sit down and try and have a large plenary meeting to sit down and start discussing how to go forward with this. As you know, there was a bill last session, general session, in which financial literacy was a task force was put together through the Department of Education or Higher Education to address this issue. And this is somewhat of an outgrowth of that, and we think although there are no silver bullets, I think the process needs to keep going forward, and so we're committed to working with this group within the industry led by Ms. Levin. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony unless you have questions.
We'd both be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nice to see you.
Yeah, maybe I'll take a moment at this time.
I was in the middle of my question. No, I'm just kidding.
I'll take a moment at this time to just welcome a new member to the committee, Representative Chris Harker, and now that the full committee is here, and introduce him to the committee, and maybe have the committee introduce themselves and state what district they represent. So, our new representative, Representative Gilliam, would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm in danger of losing my question, Mr. Chair. Which is maybe your
this
plan.
Is a test.
The whole purpose.
Vic Gilliam, District 18.
Thank you.
Which is what? For a new person.
Thank you. Is the Vice Chair can do that?
Yes, the Vice Chair can do that.
Silverton.
Yes,
wow.
She can do that.
Okay.
Larry Glazio has District 35, which is Tigard, Southwest Portland.
Donna Nelson, District 24, Yamhill and Polk Counties.
And your chair is Representative Paul Holvey, District 8, and Eugene, Vanita Lorraine, Crowe, and Notai.
I'm Chuck Riley, District 29, Hillsborough, Conias, and Forest Grove.
Sherry Springer, House District 17, and we talked at length about that.
And where is that?
We did.
Lebanon, Sweet Home, State and Sublimity.
Thank you for the introductions. I have taken the seat of now Senator Suzanne Bonamici, and that is House District 34, Beaverton, and unincorporated Washington County.
Thank you. And now that I've got that formality taken care of, Representative Gilliam, do you remember your question?
Yeah, I wanted to know who the
Not
guy
likely.
In the end was. Welcome.
Thank you.
Have a great speechwriter. Mr. Chair, I just simply wanted to know if somebody had a list of the mortgage lending group, because I can't remember who's on the group?
I'm sure we could get one. It's a pretty large list, but we can get one for you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gillian, we'll be happy to send you one. I'm sorry, I didn't bring it.
No, no problem. I was just hoping somebody had it with them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions, Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to bring up for probably the last time in my tenure here the issue of fiduciary responsibility, and on page 4, of course, that immediately upset me that under the good faith and fair dealing, that the statement that we believe that all parties to a mortgage transaction should be subject to a general obligation of good faith and fair dealing as a more workable concept than a fiduciary relationship. So I will remind the committee and Corey and David the horrid situation we had, I believe it was 4 years ago, where Washington Mutual foreclosed on our beloved Colonel Reiser, who had been shot down 4 times in 3 wars for us and at gunpoint had removed the 2 elderly people from their home. Washington Mutual holding the mortgage on the house. At the same time, this same institution allowed, without any oversight, the removal of huge sums of money by the Reiser's bookkeeper illegally, the individual having gone to prison, but the Reiser's having lost their home and everything. No matter what we did, we could not talk, and that's my concern for this right of what private right do we have to be restored. A bill was filed in the legislature. Unfortunately, it didn't come before my committee or it would have passed, requiring more fiduciary oversight by lending institutions. In this case, I mean, there should have been some flag that was going up that huge sums of money were being withdrawn out of the same bank that held the mortgage. And so I have great concern because we say we have a private right, but being fully restored for the damage that's caused is almost impossible in this state. We had other testimony regarding this similar situation.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, if that type of situation comes up with any state-licensed or state-chartered institution, that's the type of thing we would absolutely want to take regulatory action about if there's been improper removals from an account. We have the tools to address that now. Washington Mutual is a federally chartered institution, and as we've all, I think, discussed, it's very challenging to deal with those relationships, and they are beyond our control. But one of the things we were actually encouraged by as we got into our existing laws more carefully was the breadth of the tools that the legislature has granted us already to deal with those types of situations. When they come up, we have, thanks to, again, the additional resources that the legislature provided, including 2 additional enforcement staff for mortgage lending in the February session, we have been able to step up our enforcement. But that doesn't mean we find everybody, and again, some federal institutions are outside our reach. So if you're aware of any of those situations in the future with respect to state-licensed institutions, please bring them to our attention.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Based on what's happened in Washington, and Washington Mutual being bought out, we would have done a lot of people a lot of good to have taken them on in that instance, and I don't know how we failed or, you know, what else we could have done. But just proved that we were right, and it's, you know, a very sad, tragic incident.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Ms. Streisinger and Mr. Tatman, thank you very much for your testimony. I just have one small question. I'm wondering when these, I'm just reading the information, when the Regulation Z rules, these final rules, are going into effect, and do all the rules go into effect at the same time, if you're aware of that?
Mr. Chair, thanks to the good graces of your committee administrator who tipped us off that you were going to ask that question, I actually have the answer.
Thank you.
The Truth in Lending rules are primarily effective October 1st, 2009. There are some requirements, the escrow requirements applicable to high-cost loans, which are effective the following year, October 2010. The provisions in the SAFE Act, the federal legislation, the new disclosure requirements, the general disclosure requirements, are effective 1 year after passage, which is the end of July, July 28, 2009. Issues regarding variable interest rates are to be effective at a time to be established by the Federal Reserve or in 2011 at the latest, 30 months after enactment. And the loan originator licensing, the requirement that states provide for licensing of loan originators and participate in the national database, by August 2009, states have to demonstrate to the Department of Housing and Urban Development that they have made a good faith effort to adopt laws, so which is why the 2009 session is well-timed for us. And HUD is able to grant states an extension of up to 24 months, so we will have time to appropriately implement whatever we come up with.
So I'm guessing the restrictions on prepayment penalties for high-cost loans and the ability to pay standards go into effect
October 2009.
Thank you. That sums up my questions. Any further questions from the committee? Thank you very much for all your work in convening this work group, and the governor certainly for tasking the work group with looking at this issue. I think had not the federal government acted, we'd have a much different conversation right now. But I really appreciate all the work and effort your department's done in examining this issue, and look forward to the legislation from 2009 to help us comply with the federal government regulations, or at least do our part in making sure we can put some lending practice standards in place that help protect consumers and our financial markets. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, Sybil Hebb. And I have also Todd Williams and Steve Emery. If y'all want to come up, that would be great, or you can come up one at a time if you wish. So, Sybil, if you would like to go first.
Okay. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Sybil Hebb. I'm a lobbyist with the Oregon Law Center, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to testify before you this morning about this important issue and echo the thanks that have been expressed to DCBS and to the governor and to the chair, as well as the members of the committee and the work group, for all of the time and effort you've all spent in looking at and grappling with these issues. Very much appreciate it. For those of you who don't know, the Oregon Law Center is a civil legal services provider. We provide free legal assistance to low-income people throughout Oregon, and our mission is to ensure that low-income Oregonians have access to justice. We focus on issues that we believe are critical to our clients' survival. Housing issues, of course, are of great concern to our clients, and unfortunately, across the state, we have seen a rise in the number of cases that have brought clients to our doors seeking assistance because of mortgage foreclosure issues, and we believe that there are some practices that we would like to see changed in order to provide greater protection to the most vulnerable of our populations. I wanted to just sort of offer my general support of all of the protective principles that have been discussed so far. and that have been a part of the mortgage lending discussions. I wanted to tell you about sort of six key principles that we're most concerned about, and then I had some specific feedback about some of the proposals that Corey and David described this morning. And so the key principles that we're really concerned with as we're looking at all of the questions before us are really related to common sense public policy protections that provide some regulations and protections for consumers, but also allow the industry, of course, to flourish and to move forward. We do believe that the mortgage lending industry and having a strong industry is crucial for our economy. We also believe that protections are equally crucial for all vulnerable citizens, and so it's about that balance. We do think as maybe the most important principle of all is that loans should be designed to ensure success. That works both for the industry as well as for lenders, for borrowers, and that should be at sort of the core of our considering all of these discussions. We also believe that the disclosure of essential terms of a loan is fundamental, and without understanding and being able to view in a clearly identifiable manner what the essential terms are of the loan, a borrower is at a significant disadvantage in trying to assess affordability and whether or not that loan will work for the family. And it's important in that discussion that we keep track of terms that will allow the borrower to understand what are the true costs of the loan. There are lots of terms, as we know, these are complex discussions, but it's important to make sure that the terms that are being disclosed are the ones that will really allow an assessment of whether or not that payment can be made and whether success could be ensured over the long term. Or contemplated, at least. We also believe that the affirmative duty to act in good faith and according to principles of fair dealing is vital, and that needs to be present at all stages of the negotiations, and I'll talk a little bit more specifically about our concerns on that issue. Another key principle is that we want to try to preserve home equity and protect home equity, and so limitations on prepayment penalties and on fees and on points really gets at that concept for us. The other sort of final wrap-up principle is that enforcement needs to be accessible and effective. Without enforcement, the protections of principle are not worthwhile to individuals, and so enforcement is a really key mechanism, key concern. So to be more specific, I want to talk for a minute just about the good faith and fair dealing principles. We heard a little bit of discussion this morning about whether or not those principles are present in common law and codified in maybe in statutes that could be further clarified in rules. And I know that if you get a number of attorneys in a room, you're going to get that same number of opinions most likely. But I think it's very important that the work group, before deciding what to do on this, has a reasonable assurance that we're on the same page about what is the current application of the good faith and fair dealing standard. From our perspective, and with the attorneys that I've spoken with in our offices, we have a concern about relying on the common law principles solely because we think it's significantly limited in terms of the protection it can offer. It doesn't come forward quickly enough in the negotiations. One of the things that we're worried about is making sure that when a borrower goes into an office, the borrower and the lender, the broker, are engaging in communications on more or less an equal playing ground. And good faith and fair dealing allows the borrowers generally, when they go into those offices, assume that the borrower or the lender is acting according to principles of good faith and fair dealing, and they rely on that assumption to their detriment sometimes. Brokers and lenders, on the other hand, also rely on that assumption often to the benefit of the industry, and we think it's important just to make sure that there be clarity for both sides as to what are the obligations, what are the protections, and when do those get triggered. And so from our perspective, it's important that those obligations are present and protective from the very beginning of the negotiations and don't rely on further signing of paperwork or further down the line. We also think that it's really important that those protections cannot be waived. We all know that there's lots of small print to be read in going through these negotiations, and it's important from our perspective that it be very clear that the duties of good faith and fair dealing cannot be waived in the small print of a contract. They are outstanding and larger than that. The other clarification that we think is important is making sure that there is adequate enforcement mechanism that attaches to the duty of good faith and fair dealing. If we don't believe that that's in the statute, or if we don't clarify and make it clear that that's in the statute, or find a way to make it clear in the rules, we worry that enforcement will not be accessible. And so I think that's the gist of our conversation on the good faith and fair dealing from our client's perspective. Again, open to whether it's addressed by a rule or by statute, but think it's very important for all players, industry as well as consumers, that people understand what their obligations and protections are. The other concept I wanted to speak about specifically for a minute is the concept of disclosure of the essential terms of a loan. We've heard some discussion about the revisions of the good faith and estimate and the TILA disclosures that may be required by federal law, and I understand and appreciate the perspective that industry doesn't want to have to deal with lots of conflicting forms, and I think that's a valid point. To the extent that we feel that the federal forms, the federal disclosure forms, adequately provide full disclosure of those most essential terms, then that makes a lot of sense to us to rely on those forms. So far, however, those forms do not specifically require disclosure of the fully amortized minimum monthly payment. Prior to my participation on this work group, I don't think I understood what that term meant, and there are probably some who would say that I don't fully understand what it means yet, but in general, the concept is that buyers need to understand what minimum amount they need to pay in order to prevent their principal from going up over the term of the loan. And this disclosure, this particular term, is something about which there has been great confusion and lack of clarity about what is the amount of money that you need to be paying in order to prevent your loan from going up over the principal of your loan from going up over time. That is one of the terms that allows for the greatest confusion as well as potential for abuse. And so requiring that term be easily and clearly identified is really important to us in the disclosure discussion, and we think it's really essential in any buyer's ability to really truly assess affordability for the family. And so to the extent that those federal forms do not get amended to include disclosure, to require disclosure of that term, we think that it's appropriate for the state to take action and to address that. That leads me to the next point about disclosure, which is related to disclosures in languages other than English. We heard some discussion about populations people who don't speak English, who get into negotiations with lenders in their native language. These are particularly vulnerable populations in many respects. Oftentimes they are brought into a negotiation or into a storefront via advertising or soliciting in that native language. And so where a business reaches out specifically to a population in a native language, we believe that there is a corresponding obligation to make sure that disclosure of the terms that we have decided are essential to a buyer's ability to assess, that those disclosures should be made in that other language. And again, open to methods by which that responsibility is provided for, whether it's by rule or statute, but bottom line being ensuring that people have information that's understandable about what's most essential to their negotiations. Briefly to speak about the increased surety bonds, we appreciate the presentation and description of the need for increased surety bonds, and we would urge that in determining amounts, we do think it makes sense to look at volumes of both loan transactions as well as dollar amounts, but also wanting to keep in mind the practicality of whether or not a surety bond is large enough in order to actually provide relief to a consumer who has been injured as a result of violations. And those amounts need to be enough in order, we would say, at least to pay out one claim. And we think that making sure that number is significant enough will ensure protection, but also will probably incentivize better behavior from all parties. So that's our perspective on the surety bonds, and appreciate the private right of action and attorney's fees description, and would echo the comments about providing the right of action that mirrors that was passed by this body last session. And I think the sort of in summary, again, just to echo our appreciation Our goal is to provide some really reasonable and appropriate regulations that establish an underlying foundation of protection upon which borrowers can rely and that helps the industry to move forward. And we've just been very pleased to be a part of this discussion. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you, Ms. Hebb, for your testimony. And Todd or Steve?
Good morning, Chair Holvey. Good morning, committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to come before you and speak today. Just a couple things to start off with. First of all, I would echo a lot of what Sybil had to say. I know that may seem odd, but we really do. I also commend both the governor very much for putting together this work group. Many of us in this room have been working on this.
Excuse me, we need to have you identify yourself for the record.
Even Todd Williams, Evergreen Ohana Mortgage Group, Government Affairs Chair, Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals. Apparently the sign here and the tie on my finger, what? No, kidding. This has been going on for more than a year and a half. It's a very difficult issue. It's a very important issue. We absolutely applaud the governor and this body for allowing us to do the negotiations and the work in that work group that was necessary to really get through a lot of the nuts and bolts of these issues. I commend Chair Holvey. You spent countless hours attending almost every work group meeting, and that was a rarity. I also commend Representative now Suzanne Bonamici for the same. You guys were great, so I appreciate that. And our industry appreciates the ability to have open conversation and dialogue about this stuff. Specific to the items at hand, first and foremost, we are in nearly 100% support of the federal guidelines and statutes that were changed in late July. That would be the Federal Reserve's final rule and H.R. 3221, which was the SAFE Act. Second, we are equally and equally important, we are in support of the DCBS and DFCS's position as outlined in their memo of September 18th, of which you've received a summary of, and you heard testimony this morning from from both Ms. Reisinger and Mr. David Tatman. We've been talking in front of this body for years about the importance of regulating our industry such that, regardless of the delivery channel, each individual and firm is treated as equally as possible so that the consumer has the opportunity to figure out a little bit of who's on first and make an educated decision on what's best for them. Moving this stuff to the federal level is exactly what should have happened. It's exactly what did happen. We made more changes in 3 weeks than we've made in 30 years of trying to get the federal government to make some changes. So I applaud this body and those involved in helping make all that happen. Specific to some of the items left to go, we, believe it or not, we are in support of reasonable changes in our fee structure as licensees to fund greater DFCS enforcement. We had a meeting last spring with DCBS and DFCS about that very issue and our goals actually of the frequency and extent of exams of our own licensees was greater than their first level of regulation. Obviously, there's dollars that go with that that are needed to fund it, and we are actively involved and engaged in discussions with them about that. We think that that is a very crucial part to this process because without enforcement, all we're doing is adding more laws and papers on the books. Relative to surety bonds, we are not opposed to changes in surety bonds. The only key piece that this body needs to understand is that a significant amount of the mortgage delivery engine in this country today is done by small mortgage brokerage and mortgage banking firms. Firms with less than 10 people, a lot with firms with less than 5 people. As a mortgage owner, broker, banker, and loan officer myself, having just gone through all this just in the last 120 days for both Oregon and Washington, I can tell you that the costs and level of scrutiny that's going on within the actual industry to pay for and get and secure surety bonds is 5 and 10 and 20 times more difficult than it was even 2 or 3 years ago. So We are happy to have that dialogue. We're happy to have it here. We're happy to have it with DCBS and DFCS. But we will implore all of you to hear us when we talk about this dollar amount here may sound like it's a good idea because the loan size is this and therefore the surety bond should be that. But understand that as we go up that scale, we will inherently be putting a significant amount of small mortgage broker and mortgage banker businesses in this state out of business because they won't be able to meet the requirements to get those bonds. It's just important that we understand that concept. Okay? Good faith and fair dealing. We don't believe, no, I'm kidding. We absolutely believe in good faith and fair dealing. We believe, as the DFCS and DCBS noted, that the existing statutory language is in place to address that, and we are in support of any fine-tuning and definitions that are needed through the rulemaking process so that we don't have to bog down this body and the legislature with some minor interpretations and so forth. If the DFCS and DCBS later determine that they feel they don't have sufficient authority in this area, we are happy and open to addressing that dialogue at that time. We've said before, we'll say here in this public body, we are not in favor of a fiduciary obligation between a mortgage loan officer or mortgage brokerage firm and a borrower for two very important reasons. One is we are required and bound to have an agency and disclosure relationship with the lenders we do business with. And you can't have an agency relationship with one side and a fiduciary relationship with the other. We would be inherently in violation. Two, as we've seen in other states that have enacted this, you have seen two things happen. A lot of small firms close. A lot of medium and larger sized firms simply change the license type that they under which they operate to avoid the statute. And you see a significant amount of large institutional investors simply choose not to fund loans in those states because the risk level is too high. We think a good faith and fair dealing approach allows us to continue to do business and do our best to protect Oregon consumers. Side-by-side comparisons have been addressed from the DFCS. I won't go into those now. Adequate disclosure of terms of proposed, adequate disclosure of the key terms of a loan. This is an issue that we talked about in the work group at length. We've talked about here in testimony. Our association is firmly behind the side of the two main documents that we are federally bound and required to use to disclose terms to a loan, a good faith estimate and truth in lending disclosure, are not adequate documents in today's mortgage lending world. We believe that the existing statute for a lock float agreement, which is codified in Oregon statute, could be used and modified in the future to help address those issues. We believe that every borrower should have in one page, in one place, all of the key features that they need to know to make an educated decision on whether they want this loan or not. And it should be upfront during the shopping period, and it should be modified as terms of a loan change during the process. We think that that can be done by rule versus by statute. We are asking this body to hold off on that, and we recommended holding off on it in the work group, primarily because, as I'm sure you're aware, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development has a proposed rule. They are the regulatory body of those two documents to modify them dramatically. Most of their modifications we are not in support of. We think it makes a bigger mess of a bad situation. But until that gets resolved or pulled off the table, we think tinkering here at the state level will just cause yet another layer of problems. Negative amortization loans. For three different times in the last 35 years of our mortgage industry, negative amortization loans have substantially saved or been the only product available in the marketplace for even your average vanilla consumer. During the recession and very high interest rates of the early 80s, the smaller version of the same during the early 90s, and the home price explosion that we've seen across this country and in our state in the late 90s and early 2000s were one of the key vehicles to help people get into homes. Are they the preferred long-term standard of the industry? Absolutely not. but they are a vital product. They also are a more risky product, and they require a greater level of regulation and maybe a greater level of understanding and accreditation of those people that are offering or delivering those products, be it mortgage broker, mortgage banker, or insured institution. Having these changes at the federal level are helping that. Relative to Chair Holby's request about when does the SAFE Act and the Federal Reserve's final rule come into play on various things, the comments from DCBS were right on. Also know that those rules, from a practical perspective, are already in place in the industry. Nobody is making stated income loans. Almost nobody is making negative amortization loans. Almost nobody is making anything that would even look or resemble a subprime loan, other than consumer finance companies who've only been doing it the same way for about 40 years. I think they have a pretty good handle on that piece. So while there are dates in the future, and there could be a concern that there are Oregon consumers at risk in the meantime, know that those products don't even exist in the marketplace for them to be at risk. Private right of action issues. Our biggest concern is, and this is another important part that the committee needs to understand how the industry actually operates, is if a complaint is filed against my firm as a licensee, I am bound to notify every single state that I'm licensed in, every single regulatory body that regulates those states, my warehouse line of credit provider, my funding sources, and I believe my auditor of that complaint. Since bonds and lines of credit are insurance and banking products, as soon as that announcement is made, it is not uncommon for all of those things to come screeching to a halt immediately. Well, without a warehouse line of credit to fund loans, I'm out of business. Without banking sources to sell those loans to, I'm out of business, and I'm out of business today. So as soon as that complaint is filed, whether it's valid, whether it's frivolous, whether it is dealing with, you know, a $300 appraisal bill or $300,000 worth of fraudulent transactions, there is no leniency in those areas. So as we address these issues, it's important to know, again, that as we start looking at this, those repercussions are huge. They will literally start putting good Oregon companies out of business overnight. One of the proposals has been brought up to have a requirement that a complaint letter come from the consumer's attorney to our being whatever licensee is involved, agent for process or attorney of record, for them to have an opportunity to resolve the issue before it goes to litigation in a formal legal complaint, which is public record. In concept, we are in support of that. The whopping majority of our members and our industry are all about wanting to do the right thing and trying to address consumers' issues up front if they feel they've been harmed. Financial education. We have been talking about financial education for I can't tell you how long. Our association has sponsored education. Our members are ready, willing, and able to act as instructors in the junior highs and high schools in which we serve and the communities we serve to help teach our young people about financial literacy. It is crucial to the future survival of our financial markets. One of the reasons that we're dealing with the issues that we hear about every day in Wall Street right now, is in general, individually, corporately, and nationally, we haven't taken care of our financial house very well. And if nothing else, I hope that what's happened back there will be a wake-up call to all of us. Lastly, relative to one piece of the SAFE Act and the Fed rule that I want to bring up, and then I'm going to leave most of the nuts and bolts of specific issues to our resident guru of statistics over here, Mr. Emery. I think it was prudent, we've talked about it in this group numerous times, that we separate the prime or A paper borrower market from the subprime or credit challenged borrower market. That is a very important piece of what happened in that legislation. We talked about it here. The subprime borrower is a different borrower. They have different issues, different challenges. They typically either are in a financial hardship or have recently experienced a financial hardship. That's why they're a subprime borrower. People in that situation feel like, and oftentimes don't have, as many options available to them as somebody in the prime market. That subprime borrower is much more likely to take the first deal that's handed to them, whether it's the best for them, or whether they have the ability to shop it, or whether they have the ability to figure out what the terms really are. They have a situation, is whoever will give them the money first is oftentimes who they choose, even if it's not the most appropriate loan for their situation. So regulating and separating the subprime borrower from the prime borrower was a crucial and very important part of what occurred in H.R. 3221 and the Fed rule. I think that was a very important piece. With that, I will conclude my testimony with the chair's notes. I'll take any questions. Otherwise, I'll move on. Thank you very much.
Representative Riley, question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple, if I may. I wanted to talk about surety bonds. You talked about the fact that surety bonds are much more difficult to get now and more costly, I'm assuming. Can you tell me what drove that, what the cause of the surety bonds being more expensive is?
Absolutely. I'll address both pieces. If it's okay, I'll use our firm's own personal experience as an example. Relative to your first piece, the Washington surety bond for our firm went from $50,000 to $400,000 associated with a required change in the type of license that we carry now in Washington. That bond cost went from $400 to almost $4,000. That bond cost also included a CPA audit, which most small businesses never have their financials audited. Fortunately, we already had to have an audit because we have a large warehouse credit facility. Had we not had that, it would have cost us another $5,000 to $7,000 to have a certified public accountant come in and do a full audit of our books. In addition to that, it required additional background checks and personal guarantees from myself and all three of our partners, including not a deed of trust against our principal residence, but an extension through such that if there was a default and it went through the company to us individually, they would have the ability to try and attach our house, our own personal residences associated with that bond. That's an awful lot of risk. Relative to what drove it, really two things. One, for years the bonding companies have thought that mortgage broker surety bonds was pretty much easy money because nobody makes claims against them. I will defer to DCBS, but I know that from 94 when the statute went into place in Oregon until at least 2005 or so, literally only a handful of bonds had ever been attached. It's always a threat. It's always there. They were never used. So the insurance companies never paid out. Secondly is, as they started having claims, and of course the mortgage industry became front page news, they started looking to see where their risks really, really were, and as renewals came along, the requirements for renewals and decline of renewals and suspension of bonds proliferated, which is one of the reasons the number of small mortgage broker and banking firms in this state and across the country has fallen dramatically in the last 24 months. The answer to your question?
Yeah, thank you. Another question for me? A separate question. Financial education. I'd like to go there for a second, if I may. Most of the public depends on their doctor to have the medical education, and they can't possibly achieve all that education. I feel financial education is probably a very similar situation, where the general public depends on their financial institutions, however big or small they are, to have that education and to they believe, they want to believe at least, that those financial institutions are doing what is best for them when they walk in the door, just as they do when they walk into the doctor's office. You know, we know it's not always the case, but it should be. So, given that, we're never, in my opinion, going to have a fully educated public in the financial area, what can we do to ensure that the financial institutions do have the best interest for their customers when they walk in the door? What can we do about that?
Well, financial institution is a for-profit entity no different than a car dealership or a grocery store or Nordstrom or anybody else.
Or a doctor.
Or a doctor. And there are certain professions that are and should be held to a higher standard than others. I think in general the financial profession is absolutely one of those. To be perfectly honest with you, Representative Riley, I don't have a bulletproof answer to that question, but what I will tell you is that, like almost any other of the legal, medical, real estate, financial services individuals should have a basal level of education, should have to pass some examinations, should be checked out from the backside, and should, at a minimum, be required to provide in, I love Senator Buonamici's term that she used in the work group, plain language, the nuts and bolts of what they're being asked or being offered or presented to them. I think that the consumer should be the one that makes that decision of what's best for them, not the institution. No different than if I go to the doctor, I was just there this week for my semi-annual checkup, and we talked about cholesterol. His job is to tell me what he sees and to explain ways that I should address that. It's my job to determine how important I think that is in my life and what changes I really will or won't make in my life to address that issue and how important it is to me. The same goes with financial management and how much home you can or cannot afford, what I may be able to qualify a borrower for, and what they can really afford in their budget are often dramatically different things, and to some extent they should be. That should be the consumer's choice within a range of what works for them and not. Maybe that individual consumer lives very conservatively outside of their house, has a large family, wants their kids to go to a specific school district, and is willing to pay the premium for that. Somebody else may not. But I absolutely agree that we should do our best to educate those consumers so they know what questions to be asking. And in all financial services sectors, not just ours, we should do the best job we can of explaining what we're selling or offering to that customer in as simple and plain a language as possible. And frankly, the financial services industry in general has failed at that for a long time.
Thank you. I also liked Senator Bonamici's phrase, plain language. I think that's a great phrase.
I got it. thank you. Any other questions before we move
Chair
on?
Chair Holvey.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Could I ask you if that plain language related to any bill of any member of this committee that was passed in the legislature?
Well, certainly, Representative, you're asking me to give Representative Riley for recognition on his plain language bill, which did pass, yes.
And I would like to give him credit, too.
Yeah, it's great, great concept, great help to a lot of people. We'll move on to our next testifier for some bulletproof answers, Steve Emery.
Hi, Representative or Chair Holvey and representatives. I'm Steve Emery. I represent Pacific Sun Pacific Residential Mortgage. I did have a company, but I closed it about 5 months ago. As part of all this, I did bring my notes for the federal final rule and the H.R. 3221, the
200-300-page bills, and I did bring them, so Todd's right. I'm not going to repeat a lot of things. I've got a different angle on this. So a lot of things said by the division. Overall, I think the work was excellent. They had excellent issues on the understanding in the mortgage lending work group from the department. I was very impressed with their memorandum. I do have one additional comment on Mr. Tapman's comments about the YSP and the fees rules for the truth in lending issue. The reason the federal government and the Federal Reserve went ahead and had those tests, and with the consumers, is they showed consumers tests of loans without yield spread premium and with yield spread premium, and asked the consumers to choose the least expensive loan. And obviously they were doing this because all the consumer groups nationally were also going after YSP. And so they were trying to get regulation and fix the YSP issue. And what they found from the consumers in the tests is the consumers chose the more expensive loans when YSPs were disclosed with all of their different tests and forms. It shows the difficulty of trying to, number one, say that YSP is bad. It also shows the difficulty of trying to create new disclosures. Basically, in the 2009 session, Oregon needs to go ahead, and I agree 100% with the department, we need to create new statutes to enforce the SAFE Act. That's the part that has the national licensing of all loan officers, which we've been trying to support for probably 10 years. Increase surety bonds. I'm all for that. Some of you may remember back in the February session, I was proposing that myself repeatedly. It's kind of fun that some of the stuff that we were all talking about last session actually got passed by the federal government. Good faith and fair dealing. I think Sybil and Representative Riley would really like this part. If you read on my testimony, I took this right out of H.R. 3221. Good faith and fair dealing. The state of Oregon needs to come up with something, which I agree, I think it's in the rules process because we already have the proper statutes to establish this. But read that. Establishes a means by which residential mortgage loan originators would, to the greatest extent possible, be required to act in the best interest of the consumer. I think we don't really need to do a lot on that because it's already done. I mean, it's done. This is federal law. This is passed. This is signed. This is in place. That's pretty heavy duty from somebody in the industry. Representative Riley?
I agree with you that sounds great. How do we have the ability to enforce that? And what does it mean? How do you determine if someone has the best interest of their clients? I don't know how you determine that without specific details of what that means.
Representative Riley, you're exactly right. And in the mortgage lending work group, Corey Streisinger has made mention that she feels that in the rulemaking process, we can come up with different bullet points of things that the division would say do not meet that type of a criteria. Can we cover it all? No, it would not be an all-inclusive list, but we could definitely come up with 10 or 15 things that say, if you do this, you're a bad person. And, you know, you're not meeting this criteria. And talking about that also, we need to give them additional examination staff. We've gone from one a couple 3 years ago to three or four now. I'd love to see us have 10. There's still, 3,000 entities out there doing mortgages in the state. So getting more staff, putting laws on the books without giving them staff to go after them is worthless. So we need to give them the additional staff to go after these people and see what's going on. So having said all that, I support those issues. I don't support the rest. I want to take a big picture view here. We all probably have seen on the news what's happening to the stock market and the financial markets and the credit markets all collapsing. Do we all know why? The why is the credit crisis, which mortgages are a big part of that, but so are commercial loans and other types of loans. It's a credit crisis. Many of the reasons that this stuff started collapsing a year and a half ago was because of the non-traditional guidance issued by the federal government back in 06. That caused difficulties in the mortgage business. That caused difficulties on the financial markets and investors to buy these SIVs and CDOs and all these other anacrims that we've all heard. Then the subprime guidance came out in June of 07. That caused additional difficulties. We are seeing things happen today from those events that happened on the federal level probably a year ago. In the last, I get kind of excited about this, so I gotta stay calm. In the last 60 days, we have seen more changes on the federal level than it's impossible to describe. They've happened faster,
and they've done more than any of us expected in the industry or any of us in the mortgage lending group thought would happen. They've gone further. The federal rule, the final federal rule for the Truth in Lending Act that was approved on July 14th takes effect in 10-1, though many of those things are coming into place today. H.R. 3221, which is called the HERO Act, it's got the SAFE Act in it. It's got FHA modernization in it. It's got all kinds of stuff in it. But the Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008, signed by the President on July 30th, has other effective dates. The FHA modernization parts of it already took effect. We lost the down payment assistance program yesterday. Major effects are happening on this, not just the official dates of when certain parts of the statutory requirements come into place, but also in practice, what the industry does changes almost weekly and monthly on this. There's a new federal housing agency. We have a new acronym to learn, FHFA, Federal Housing Finance Agency. Any one of these things happening in our lifetime would be a generational, huge event. To have all three of them, the takeover, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, how could I forget that? Any one of these events would be huge. To have all three of them happen in 60 days is, there's not enough adjectives for me to even say it. It's beyond scope. The industry is reeling trying to figure out the new requirements. It's going to take, the reason some of these things don't take effect for 6 months or a year is because it takes that long for HUD to issue the mortgagee letters that tell us how to implement. Just like you guys create the legislature creates a statute and then there's rulemaking for the next 6 months to enforce that statute. That's what they're doing. They're creating the rules. They're going to take this 260-page law and probably issue 1,000 pages on it. That takes time to implement and to do, and they're in the process of doing that. Not just, it used to be I would get an underwriting change maybe every 3 or 4 months. I don't come to work a day, hardly anymore, that I don't get major changes. Just in the last couple of days, a couple of my major lenders restricted condos and PUDs attached, which is like townhomes, 20% down. No more 10% down, no more 5% down. That's a major hit. That's owner-occupied. I'm not even talking investment. That's a major hit, and it happened 2 days ago. We had major changes to non-owner-occupied lending in the last week, and this stuff is happening constantly. So what I'm trying to impress is the amount of stuff that's coming, the restrictions that are coming, and approval standards. And that's not from these things that just happened 60 days ago. It's from things that happened 6 months ago. The stuff that just happened the last 60 days are going to hit us like a ton of bricks over the next 6 to 9 months. And then we're going to learn what we really are doing. Here's another interesting thing. Washington Mutual was taken over by the FDIC. IndyMac is taken over by the FDIC. Wachovia is taken over by the FDIC. Didn't even make front page news, hardly. They talked about it. It was a minor sideshow because there was so much other turmoil in the credit markets. Two of these are the fourth and the sixth largest banks in our country. They're huge. All because of the mortgage crisis and credit crisis. And to talk about negative amortization loans, I'll tell you, if you want to punish the mortgage industry for negative amortization loans, Washington Mutual, Countrywide, and Wachovia, through its acquisition of World Savings, because World Savings is the one that did it, but World, Washington Mutual, and Countrywide probably did 90% of the negative amortization loans in the country, and they're gone. They're closed. Their stockholders are punished. They're gone. So, it's a big deal. They've lost billions, so that punishment has happened. I'm not going to go through the details of all the new federal rules. Corey Streisinger and David Tapman went through them in detail, and they were, I went down and I'm thinking, man, I just checked off all my things I was going to say because that's what I agree with them 100%. All the new changes coming. So the thing I would like to impress upon the legislature is the overwhelming, huge amount of new things coming down the pipe from the federal government, new disclosures, new underwriting, restrictions on loans. I would ask that we only implement the items that we need to do to meet federal requirements, which are all good. I agree with those. And not do anything else for a couple of years. Let's not mess around with trying to do ability to pay on negative AM loans that really don't exist at this point anyway. Let's not mess around with some of these other things. And here's a problem. I actually support some of these things, as Chair Holding knows from being in the Mortgage Lending Work Group, but not now. There is so much coming. There is so much coming at us. Not now. That's all I'm saying. In my testimony, I wrote down some additional things. People talk about gaps. They talk about state bans on products. And when you create
there are so many states. Being that I've worked at a couple of major lenders, I get memos from Wells Fargo and Chase on a national basis, for example. When these different states like Connecticut, Minnesota, North Carolina, Illinois, Florida, Massachusetts, they pass these state-specific definitions of higher-priced loans. They pass these state-specific ability to pay things. Every single one of these major lenders issues out these memos. No more will we do loans in those states and buy them from mortgage lenders if they meet the criteria by that particular state's requirement. It's not just one or two. It's a lot. And it's major lenders pulling out. Now, does Wells Fargo still do loans in Massachusetts? Absolutely, as a federal bank. They just don't buy them from the state-licensed mortgage lenders and state-licensed mortgage brokers. So if our intent is to wipe out all state-licensed mortgage lenders in Oregon, that would be a good thing to do, but I don't think that's our intent. So, you know, we don't want to do anything else right now. I don't know if you can see the fear in me right now. That's please don't do anything else. Yeah, that's the end of my testimony. Unless there's more questions.
Thank you, Mr. Emery, and I do see the fear in your face. I didn't see it last February as much as I do now. I think any other questions from the committee? Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Chair Holby. Mr. Emery, I don't, this may be a question for Corey, but did you say there are 3,000 licensed state lenders?
I don't have an accurate number, but the numbers that I've seen over the last 2 years have been decreasing dramatically. I've seen numbers where somebody said we had 3,100 licensed locations. I've seen numbers where we had 1,500 licensed locations. I think what happens is it depends whether or not you're saying whether they're within the state of Oregon or if they're overall the whole country. And that might be a better question for Corey, but I do believe that there's somewhere around that number, and you'd need enough examiners to actually go out and talk to these people and not just wait for a consumer to file a complaint, but to be proactive and be out there enough to find it before it happens.
Just a quick follow-up.
And
maybe this is a court question also. I'm just curious of the volume of business with the state lenders versus federal.
We just last, I think with February session, passed a law that says the mortgage lenders have to file reports now annually saying what our volumes are. I know I did mine. I don't know if the state has really precise numbers on that. Nationally, the mortgage industry claims that we do somewhere around 50%, the mortgage brokers and state licensed people versus the national lenders, that we do about 50% of the production nationally. I think the state probably is going to have some very precise numbers that they can then compare with the mortgage banking data and probably give you exact numbers anytime.
And just one quick follow-up. Well, then I would tend to want to disagree with you regarding, you know, our responsibility as legislators looking after our people. If it is a 50-50, that we have to do what is what is essential to protect our consumers.
I understand that concept. I don't agree with it, but I do understand that concept from other opposing viewpoints. I think we need to protect our consumers. That's not what I'm saying. But I do disagree that we should put extra burdens on state-licensed businesses and state-licensed people, you know, on a regulatory level for the product that's a national product. We've gone into detail at different meetings talking about that issue too, but, you know, this stuff is being done on a federal level and it happens to all players and all people. Isn't it better that we stop everybody from doing bad practices with certain types of lending rather than just stop half of the market in Oregon? Because all that really happens if you stop the half in Oregon is probably most of us would end up working for a federal bank, which the federal banks would then love, and then competition would be less. And I don't think we should put extra burdens on state licensed people and small businesses in Oregon as opposed to our people across the street that do loans. So
Representative Gilliam, a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Emery, I appreciate you being here again. I appreciate you being part of the work group. I don't know what role, but I know you, from your testimony, you were a participant. When I look through this, summary that we got earlier, I just want to make sure that I understand from your perspective, when you caution us not to do any more, which I can appreciate, as I look at these recommendations coming out of the work group so far, there are very few, correct me if I'm wrong, recommendations for actual legislation in 09. There's wait and sees, that's correct, at the rulemaking level. You were very specific about one, on negative amortization. And I think you probably echo the one on hold off till HUD tells us a little more about the refinance issue. But are there other specific ones in here? And if I missed it, I apologize. But are there specific recommendations from the work group's report that you are cautioning us over, I mean, specifically over and above the general recommendation you made?
Well, the increased surety bonds, fair dealing, the enforcement of federal standards are all required. The refinance loan side-by-side comparison, or even the department says they want to wait on that till HUD and everybody finishes their thing because they'll probably come up with something similar. And the negative amortization loans, yeah, I personally think, and I agree with Todd, we all talk from what we experience in the short term. And in the short term, the last 4 or 5 years, the only people mainly that did negative am were people that were stretching on payments because they were speculative, buying hoping houses would go up in value. But in the early 80s and in the early late 80s, actually, mid-90s, like 95, 97, I did a fair amount of those loans for people. Because rates were 8.5%, 9.5%, and it was the only way they could buy into the house in the hopes of keeping a payment somewhat reasonable. The disclosures, by the way, on these loans going back 10 years show people very specifically, they're called option arms. You know why they're called option arms? Because you have four payment options. So every single piece of paper the customer sees has four payment options. Yes, they many times choose the smallest one, but the other three are there. So, you know, it is very clear. The refinance comparison thing, the yield spread premiums, I agree with their on that. The disclosures other than English, for many reasons, I'm not fond of that one, though it's not for an understanding issue. It's more of a putting it into practice issue to me. I know what I'm going to do if I was a business owner. I'm just going to, if you give me three forms and three languages, I don't know if my loan officer talked to somebody in that language, and, you know, we're a relationship business, so more than likely they did at a business function or a notary meeting or a chamber of commerce or whatever. They talked to them in that language. They maybe on their card have something in Vietnamese and handed it out. So I'm going to get accused by a court of law that they were marketing in that language. And so to cover myself as a business owner, if you give me three sets of forms, every single customer I do is going to sign all three. It just becomes a major issue to me. I don't understand. I'm not an attorney, so I don't understand enough about the private right of action and attorney's fees issue. I'm sorry. That one's over my head. Just say attorney scares me. So that one, you know, on a guttural level, that kind of bothers me. But it may be fine. And, of course, I support consumer education. I'll tell you, in the, which one is it? The 3221? There are hundreds of millions of dollars in this bill for education. And I know the state's going after that. I've asked them about it, and they're going after some of that money for Oregon. Did I answer your question?
Yes, you did.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Galizio.
Yeah, I just one question, Mr. Chair, because I was fascinated what you just said, Mr. Emery. So if I came into your office, we were talking about a loan, and I was speaking to you in English, and you had this new requirement, and I was going to sign documents, you would hand me the document that was in Vietnamese, and then you'd hand me the one in Spanish? Is that what you're telling me?
I would imagine that the owners of my company would require me to. If I own the company any longer, I would require it to. I'll go ahead and say something. I'm from California back in the... I did loans in California up until 93. When California came out with a Spanish form requirement on certain documents to help people understand, and it was very noble, and I understand that, the company I worked for, we were given those forms, and we were told anybody with a... Now, I didn't have to do it unless it was a Spanish surname, but I remember a certain Mr. Martinez who came in and took a loan from me shortly after that took effect, whose family had been in California for 4 or 5 generations. His grandfather didn't speak Spanish, and he got rather offended when I handed him a bunch of Spanish disclosures and told him he had to sign them. And he didn't want to sign them. But, you know, is well, then you don't get the loan because I have to have these signed. So you can sometimes create problems in the best, you know, you have the best noble purpose. And I've said in the mortgage lending work group, I would rather see, instead of doing three disclosures in three languages, I would rather see us do a piece of paper, maybe a legal-sized piece of paper that has a statement in English about getting your own interpreters, that this is an important transaction and you should understand it. I don't even mind if it says, really look at your good faith estimate. Then another paragraph in Spanish, Russian, Vietnamese. I mean, heck, there's 80 languages just in the Beaverton School District. How many do we want to do? But let's do a form and then require that, by statute, be in every single loan signed in the state of Oregon. That would be fine, because then it's going to be one form, explains to you that you should, you know, a warning and a disclosure that you should go out and get somebody to help you understand this important transaction, other than the loan officer that's making a commission. I understand that concept. But one form, bunch of paragraphs, different languages, sign it. That would be easy to implement, easy to support, and it's not going to get me involved with an attorney saying 2 years from now, after the state's been nobled enough to say that I should do the good faith estimate in that language, that now, you know, well, does that mean the other 14 pages aren't important? Maybe, I mean, now I'm going to, I can just see it growing and being a problem and liability. And, you know, so, you know, at the same time, you know, I understand trying to make people understand stuff. I actually, when I was in California, took Spanish lessons so I could help my Spanish customers. I don't speak it anymore, but did I answer your question?
I feel like I'm watching the vice presidential debate.
That's tonight at 6.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Ms. Hebb, did you have a comment?
Thank you, Chair Holvey. I just would offer that I think it's possible to put some reasonable and understandable guidance in the rules about how and when those obligations would be triggered. So I would look forward to that discussion to avoid the outcome.
Thank you. Well, I sincerely appreciate both of you and Todd as well. He's not here. Staying engaged, and many others staying engaged in this since the infamous Senate Bill 965 in the 07 session. This conversation has been ongoing, informational, and I think very fruitful for this committee and the state of Oregon, hopefully. And I encourage you to stay engaged in as we go into 2009 if you can. I think it's very important to have both your perspectives in front of this committee as we consider these issues. Certainly, I think that is would be my wish. I hope you're able to continue that dialogue. I don't have any other questions for you at this time. I just appreciate your participation.
Thank you
very much. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you. I think at this time I'm going to recess for 3 or 4 minutes before we get into the next section, and I know some of those may not be staying for the next piece. Mr. Tapman, I know that you're not on our agenda, but if you have time to stay, it might be useful for the chair to have you in the next discussion on business entities.
Mr. Holder, I'm happy to do that. I also have just a 30-second bite for
Representative
Nelson. I've got the number sheet
out. Oh, certainly. Good. Appreciate that forthcoming.
Isn't that special?
So again, for the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Tapman with the Department of Consumer Business Services. Mr. Emery's correct. We have just instituted, as of last February when we were authorized, we are now collecting data that is still ongoing. As you can imagine, since this is a new process, a lot of people are either slow or delayed in submitting information. So we don't have the numbers yet from our own local folks. However, I do have some information. One, what we've been told by the Mortgage Bankers Association, the National Association, is it approximately somewhere in the mid-60s, which I think it's 64% of loans, either financing or refinancing, are done through state-licensed entities. So the vast majority, or at least a significant majority of loans are done through the people we license. Now,
in many instances, that's the broker making the negotiated loan, and then a federally chartered banker may be funding that loan. So you got both sides of that. But I think that goes to the issue that Representative Nelson brought up. Secondly, as of the end of 2007, we had approximately 1,706 licensed mortgage bankers and brokers. The vast majority are brokers. And I think the numbers were approximately 700 in-state and 1,000 out-of-state, but I may be wrong about that. We are working diligently just to reiterate on the licensing process. We're right now on a cycle to try and meet every in-state licensee within a three-year cycle. And if we add bodies, we'd like to get that up to two. The challenge for us is reaching out to the people out of state, and we're looking at a number of different options, including partnering with other states and maybe coming up with consortiums where a number of states go out at once to expedite the out-of-state exams. In addition, there are approximately 8,000 loan originators, and both mortgage lenders and loan originators have gone down dramatically. Right now, it's approximately 4,000 in-state and 4,000 out-of-state, and we've seen the out-of-state loan originators really decline, and I think that's a reflection on the market drying up. So those are the numbers, and there's definitely a downward slope. We don't know if we've hit bottom or not yet, but we're certainly keeping a close eye on that.
Thank you, Mr. Tatman. With that, I'm going to recess for four or five minutes. Thank you. And I apologize for my invitees who've been sitting patiently listening to mortgage lending issues without falling asleep. And committee, this is a topic that actually we talked about in 2007 a little bit with the Secretary of State's office as well as DCBS. And it's a pretty interesting issue that we have, and I think it's one the state of Oregon needs to look at. So with that, I'd like to bring up Peter Threlkill, and I don't know if David Tatman wants to come up with him at this point, or you want to sit back and wait for another place to interject.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what I'd have to add. At this point, basically shared with your committee most of what we are aware of. I'm happy to be available to answer questions, and I'll stay through the process.
All right. Then I'll bring up Donna Maddox at the same time then. Thank you. And committee, this is a topic of basically business entities and their formation and their registration in the state of Oregon and some of the activities that they do or don't do in the state of Oregon, as well as some of the activities they sometimes do outside the state of Oregon, and you know, our ability to basically keep track of it is come into question. As I don't know if any of you remember, I did have a bill in 2007 which passed the House floor on this issue. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Peter Threlkill, and I hope I keep saying I always get your name mixed up and don't pronounce it quite right. But
that was just fine.
From the Secretary of State's office, Corporation Division. So if you'd introduce yourself, since I've already done it.
Certainly. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Peter Threlkill. I'm the Director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's office. This is an issue that we've been interested in and trying to come up with solutions for a little bit of time now. We originally, this came to our attention when we had an investigator from U.S. Customs come and sit down with us and talk about some problems that they were seeing, basically either trying to come into the United States or in other countries around the world as shipments of goods are moving between other countries. We later got an opportunity to work with our local office of the FBI, and some of those gentlemen are behind us, and we'll come up in a minute, I believe. and really got to start to get a broader understanding of the issues at hand. Basically, in the handout under the area of misuse of shell companies, I tried to illustrate what we see as a common example, and that's where you have elements of organized crime in other countries, primarily in Europe and Asia. They will make a contact through, generally it's a law office in a offshore tax haven, countries like Belize, Gibraltar, Seychelles, that are fairly traditionally known as offshore tax havens. I think as we tend to think of that in America, that would be where American criminals would go to hide their assets from tax authorities or governments, and you know, places that had strong bank secrecy laws. In the last decade or so, especially with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the rise of organized crime in those countries, we've started to see a little bit of a different take on these scenarios, and now those elements are using U.S. business registration laws as a way to shield their identity and gain some credibility around the world. So they'll come to America, they'll open up businesses, corporations, and limited liability companies. They'll then take those and go open bank accounts in foreign countries, usually again in Europe and Asia, and with the purpose of using those companies and those accounts to launder money that they've gained through whatever illegal activities that they're doing. They tend to be very careful. I've gone out and just Googled some of these concepts, and you can find websites that are out there that talk about how you do this, and the advice that those sites will give is that when you set up an American company, you don't want to have an office here, you don't want to have employees here, and you don't want to have any income or profits here. You know, doing any one of those things will subject you to the jurisdiction of U.S. law, and they're not interested in that. They're trying to stay overseas, and so we've seen a kind of a reverse of what an offshore tax haven is for these organized crime elements in other parts of the world. It's using a U.S. corporation or a U.S. company. So to kind of complete the process there, the usually it's an attorney's office in a tax haven. They'll contact, they'll either go through a website that a company like LegalZoom or some other company here in the States, and they'll say, well, we want to set up a company. We want to set up a limited liability company. They also contact individuals that live here in the state and pass along that same information. Those folks will then go and act as incorporators. They'll come to our office and they'll form a business. Oregon law is pretty specific that if you provide certain information and it meets the standard of the law and we review the documents for that, then you're able to start and set up a company. So I think on the next page, really we start getting into where the federal government has started to take an interest. Earlier this year, Senators Levin, Coleman, and Obama introduced Senate Bill 2956, the Incorporation Transparency and Law Enforcement Assistance Act, to really deal with some of these issues. In many ways, it's a stick that the federal government is kind of holding up to get the states to take some action. One of the things that the bill would do is that it really takes the processes that have been set up in the states over the last 50 and 100 years and kind of turns it on its head. It would require that each state update its business registration laws to restructure the function of state agencies to go from basic a ministerial role to one of collecting, verifying, and processing and investigating ownership information. Now, certainly, if that's something that we want to do, we can go down that path and we could implement that. It's just a very big departure from the way we've been set up to run our division and run our functions. So it would be a pretty substantial change. In the proposed federal legislation, they do look to as it's currently written, they're looking for, they have a deadline of October 2010 for the law to be implemented. And the other part of the stick that they have there is that states that didn't implement their proposals would possibly risk losing Homeland Security grant funding. So now, with that said, the legislation has yet to receive a congressional hearing. Given all the other issues that they're dealing with today, upcoming elections, I doubt that they're really going to take this up until they reconvene in January. So, and even at then, I don't know, you know, where their what their time frame is. So, one of the things that that we've been trying to do is really look at, you know, what are good alternative proposals, legislative solutions. We've been doing some work with, you know, really looking at the efforts that are coming out of NCUSL, which is now known as the Uniform Law Commission. They've been creating model acts for all state governments for over 100 years, and all of our business registration laws, business laws are really based on NCUSL model acts today. So some of the things that they've been working on really will come out, we hope, within the next few months, within the next year. Our biennial legislative session may or may be a problem there if, you know, if their legislation is going to come out after our session wraps up. So some of the things I think that are important to look at in the and I've provided some links here to the model acts that are coming out of NCUSL. But some of the things that they do is that they would require that each company has a records office, and that would be where the ownership records are kept. Oregon law currently requires that corporations, limited liability companies, have to keep their lists of shareholders, their lists of members who are owners for limited liability companies, but they either have to be kept at their principal office, which doesn't have to be in Oregon, or with their registered agents. So the NCUSL Act would specify that in the filings they would tell us where their records are going to be retained. They would require that the businesses identify any foreign owners that they have, either through a passport or with a photo page or driver's licenses. It would also change some of the roles of an incorporator. Currently today, if you are an incorporator, you just have to be 18 years of age or another business entity, corporation. Once you've the role of the incorporator is to basically do the process of incorporation, or, you know, filing the document with our office to create a business. Many new businesses may not have all of their officers, their directors. They may not have had an organization meeting at the time they're filed. Today, the incorporator's role ends when the incorporation is done. But under the NCUSL Model Acts, that would continue until such time as the company has appointed directors. So it provides a little bit of a bridge there for somebody that's responsible for those companies. wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, where our laws are today and what's required with when you want to register a business. The initial registration comes to us. The law requires that there's a name of the business. It requires that there's a an individual name and a street address for the in-state resident who will accept a legal service on behalf of the company in case somebody needs to sue them. They are required to provide a name and address of each person who's forming that business, and these are the would be the incorporators. They're also required to provide a mailing office so that we can send notices to them and communicate with them if they don't have a principal office yet. Every person that's signing that or that's forming that business has to sign the document. Then if the document comes to us, we review it against the law. If it satisfies the law requires us to accept it and file it. Then a year later, we're going to ask for some additional information in the annual report. This is designed to give the business time to go through their processes, to form and organize, come up with their bylaws, and really kind of set up their operations. At that time, they're required to provide us a principal office. Again, that can be in Oregon. It could be in another state. The law doesn't say that it even has to be in the United States of America. We have principal offices that are located in Belize and some of these other offshore tax havens. And that's how we have some sense of how many of those companies are out there, which ones might be a little bit suspect. I think the last time that we ran database queries looking at that information, we had, I believe, a little over 1,500 businesses that had a principal office or an officer located in the country of Belize. Down in Central America, probably not going to be on the top of Oregon's trading partners. So not that we have any evidence that there's wrongdoing there, but that does seem a little suspicious to us. Then the additional information that's required in the annual report are really the who are the governors of the company. If it's a corporation, this would be the president and the secretary. If it's a limited liability company, it would be who are the managers if the company's managed by managers, or who at least one member if it's managed by its members. So, and a member of a LLC is the equivalent of an owner. So what we have today is we have business laws and registration process that relies heavily on the integrity and the honesty of the person that's filing. For the vast majority of Oregon's businesses who are very small mom-and-pop operations, maybe a couple of partners, I think that works. You know, I think that the vast majority of the people that that are out there that we all deal with that really drive Oregon's economy are honest, hardworking individuals that want to do the right thing. This is something that allows us to keep their costs of compliance to a minimum. It's something that streamlines our administrative processes, which allow us to keep our costs down and be able to react to requests to or form new businesses very quickly. But it also opens up a path that dishonest people and criminals can take advantage of Oregon's laws. They can hide and conceal the identity of their owners, and principally that would be from law enforcement. And people that might want to look to prosecute or at least track down folks whenever there's some wrongdoing happening. Looking at what Oregon should do, you know, I strongly support the efforts that are coming out of NCUSL, the Uniform Law Commission. One of the things there is that, you know, those efforts really help Oregon and all states to, you know, promote commerce, interstate commerce, and you know, we want to, as much as possible, avoid a patchwork of state business laws, because so much of our business and other states' business, you know, just really crosses into the other states. And you know, the more complicated that each state makes it, the more difficult it is for businesses to come here, to go into other states. And, you know, I think especially in light of current situations, we really want to take a hard look before we do something that's dramatically different from what's happening in most of the other states. Now, as I said, NCUSL is taking a serious look at this problem. You know, we expect that they'll have something out, you know, hopefully within the year. If they don't, we're prepared to come up with and bring forward legislation in the next session that we feel will be supportive of the efforts from the NCUSL. They'll still have an opportunity to make changes to what they're doing, but based on what we've reviewed currently and the direction they look to be going, I think that our concepts will be in line with that. I think that they'll support the goals of the proposed Senate legislation, and they're also in line with some of our neighbor states' actions that Nevada and Wyoming took in the last year, and existing laws that Colorado and Massachusetts have had on their books for a little bit of time. And I'd, you know, be happy to kind of talk a little bit about, you know, where we think our concepts can go, in case Oregon wants to do something here in this next session and not wait for a full package to come out of NCUSL.
Thank you. A question for you, I guess, is on these registration when the business entity forms, they're also required to pay a fee, I believe, at that time, and I think they're also, whether they're LLCs or corporations, pay an additional fee annually with their anniversary date or report that they have to file. And I want to know how much that is, and also do we have the ability to see, you know, where the funds are coming from, who's paying for it? I mean, is it just being paid for a bank, or, I mean, do we track, you know, where the money's coming from to pay for their formation, you know, ultimately? Because certainly an agent isn't just going to pay for it out of his pocket without getting some sort of paper. So do we actually track where the money comes from to form these companies?
Okay. Chair Holby, the fees in Oregon are a flat $50 to form a company, and the annual report fee is also $50. Our office receives any number of forms of payment, whether it's credit card or cash or check, but primarily it's credit card. Also some checks. Check and credit card transactions, we have an ability to go back and, you know, review that information. It's captured in our system. We get a CD every month from U.S. Bank that basically shows all the, provides us images of all the checks that have come through and paid for services with us. A registered agent, attorneys, different service company firms will manage the process of annual report renewal for businesses that are their clients. It's very common that an attorney's office or a registered agent may make the payment through their credit card, and that's the information that would show up to us, that it was from the registered agent. And so it wouldn't necessarily, we wouldn't be able to track back to who is it that paid that registered agent.
I guess that was my question. So the the registered agent isn't required to disclose, you know, who the owner is or who's making the payments for the company.
Not in under current law, but that is really the gist of pending legislation that comes from NACUSL, the concepts that we are creating, and really would put that onus on the registered agent, so that they would have to collect and retain that information, and then when law enforcement came to our office and said, you know, we'd like you to go request these ownership records, we would be able to issue a demand out to that registered agent. They would then have a set period of time, whether it was 30 days or 60 days, that they would have to produce those records to the state. And then in a case where they didn't, you know, we feel they should be subject to either some form of penalty, and also that should be grounds for the state to dissolve that business.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm hoping somebody can tell me what the benefit to the state of Oregon is to having a company registered with the state of Oregon and has no employees in Oregon, has no business in Oregon. Thank you.
Chair Holvey, Representative Brad. I really don't have a strong answer there. You know, I think that, you know, some of the differences in business law, you know, I think we're aware that, you know, there's a lot of companies that register in Delaware. They do so primarily because, not because the registration process is easy or they're based there. It's just that their company acts then get favorable treatment under Delaware state law. And so, you know, the laws really around the company, I think that's the primary reason, but the organized crime folks, they're not looking for any advantages under our law. They're just looking for secrecy around the world.
Follow-up. So I understand Delaware's that the reason people register in Delaware, they get a lot of financial breaks for registering there and don't have to pay some of the fees in other states where they actually do business. But I really would like to have someone tell me, you know, if they have no employees in Oregon and they don't do any business in Oregon, why do we want them registered in Oregon? What is the benefit to the state? And if there is none,
$50.
Yeah, $50 doesn't do it. It costs more than that to take care of them. So if there is none, then I think, you know, it's time for us to stop doing it.
Thank you, Representative Riley. I believe I asked Mr. Threlkill that a year and a half ago, almost precisely that same question, and whether or not the $50 is really worth it. So, further questions for Mr. Threlkill? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe this is for the agents that are coming forward, but when we're talking about organized crime, principally, this is Homeland Security money fighting this. We're talking about terrorism. But are we talking about drugs? What other types of, quote, organized crime are we most worried about in this state?
Representative Holvey, Representative Nelson, I certainly don't want to imply that there aren't criminals residing in this state, because we all know that there are. And I believe that Donna has some information to talk about that as well. But, I think that, you know, the issues that I'm aware of that these crime elements are involved in are pretty much everything that you could possibly imagine. This issue and the primary issue that the federal legislation is concerned with is specifically that international group of organized crime, and that's primarily why I focused my testimony today on that issue. It's not necessarily, they're not really concerned with common criminals that that we might have here in Oregon. They're looking at a much bigger, more well-financed group in the congressional legislation. I believe Senator Levin indicated these folks control something in the neighborhood of $35 billion.
So, and maybe we'll listen to the rest of the testimony to get a full picture before we get into too many more questions. And with that, I'd like to go ahead and have Ms. Mannix provide her testimony. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
I will. Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Donna Mannix. I am the attorney in charge of the Organized Crime Section at the Oregon Department of Justice. The Organized Crime Section is one of two legal sections in the Criminal Division. Our primary mandate is to work with local law enforcement and other state agencies in combating organized crime and complex crimes in Oregon. I know that Peter Throckhell talked more specifically about international organized crime and how they are using shell companies in Oregon to achieve some of their ends. I was asked to come here today to provide you some examples of how criminals in Oregon are using these laws to commit crimes here. I have a number of examples that are in my testimony that you can review. I will go through those. I did want to let you know up front that the majority of crimes that we see, at least in the area that I work in, where people are utilizing the business entities' laws to create businesses and to continue to commit crime, lots of tax evasion. State tax evasion, and it can happen on a pretty wide scale. But it does go the entire range, a variety of crimes, anything where you would need to have a business license in order to go get an additional license with the state to keep promoting what you're doing. The gateway or the first step you're going to take is getting that business license. I also wanted to let you know that the examples that are in here, all but one, are closed adjudicated cases. I put them in here for the specific purpose of picking cases that might highlight some different problems we have seen, both in our office and working with other law enforcement agencies, state and federal level. There's only one case in here that I provide a generic example because we have an ongoing case. So you can feel free to ask me specific questions about the business licenses and the cases where I actually have folks who are named. So with that, I am going to go over the list of examples I have here, which I do think illustrate how criminals in Oregon have been using the business registration laws in order to really facilitate their crimes. The first one here that I've indicated is the JK Wholesale case. One of the sections in my unit is, covers the tobacco tax enforcement unit. We have attorneys and investigators who have specifically been working on combating criminal tax evasion. This is a case that was a three-year investigation that actually I worked myself. Before I talk about the difficulties with the registrations, I will tell you that I believe that this investigation probably would have been much shorter had we been able to determine early on who was really behind these business entities that had been registered with the state. At the end of the day, we estimated a tax loss to the state of over $1 million. We were able to get a judgment for about $500,000 at the end, and the primary defendant did plead guilty to a Class A racketeering charge where we named the business entities as part of that racketeering enterprise and was sentenced to 16 months in prison. In these cases, individuals go around and they're leaving receipts at stores, which is how we typically find out what they're doing in the first place. We were able to find receipts that said JK Wholesale at the top, but had very difficult time determining who was behind that entity. Obviously, store owners were not very willing to talk to us about who these folks were because there was some questionable activity happening. Through surveillance and interviews and years of investigation, we were able to determine that JK Wholesale was a registered business and that there were two other related businesses that were registered to the same address. You'll see on the second page of my testimony that the three different businesses registered to the same address were all different names, and we weren't sure. We believe there were family relations, but we weren't sure who was controlling this. Until I was able to gather enough evidence really to be able to charge all of the family members, there were four of them involved, with specific racketeering crimes, in addition to nine other individuals, I had no idea who was controlling this. We were able, after indicting and arresting all the individuals to get the person who did really control the operation to cooperate with us. He did that in order to put the rest of his family in better graces with the state. But what he explained to us was that, and it became clear that he was the controller because he was the only one in the family that actually spoke or wrote English. He had filled out all the business registration forms in the name of someone else in his family and submitted them and had continued to submit the annual updates that were needed in someone else's name. There was really nothing in the system that prevented him from doing that as long as he made those payments. And again, the only way we were able to find out that he was the one that was controlling the operations was because he was willing to cooperate with us and explain how he set this up. He also indicated to us that he was taught how to do this by another store owner who understood the soft spots in the law and knew that he could create layers of separation between himself and the people that were actually doing the fraud by putting different levels of people between the untaxed tax tobacco products he had in his hand, the person that was registered, and then actually the person that was engaged in the business. So there were multiple layers here, and it was interesting to me that we have often joked that there must be a guidebook out there, that the criminals know where the soft spots are, and they work together to exploit them, and then they actually go about teaching others how to work in concert with them. So again, there are a couple other issues I hit here, but this not being able to determine really who's behind the company. In this case, we had names that were picked, that were intentionally picked in order to be misleading for out-of-state businesses that these folks were dealing with. And again, the principal place of business that was listed really had no connection to these folks. And for a substantial part of this investigation, they actually did not live in Oregon. They were living in Washington and didn't live at the listed address. I don't know if anyone has questions on that particular case before I move on to the next one. I'll continue.
Go ahead. Thank you.
The next example is the only example I have here where, again, this is we do have an ongoing related case, so I'm giving you an example. This is a fraud that is happening all across the United States right now in the construction business. I imagine with the slowdown in the construction industry, we will see less of it, but it certainly has been a major player in the last few years. As stated here, an individual will register a shell company with the intent of really just getting the paperwork they need to get started to operate as a subcontractor, to go ahead and get their CCB license and the other things they need. They then claim they have a small number of employees for payroll and that they pay minimal workers' comp premiums in order to receive an insurance certificate. So they get the business license, then they get their CCB, then they get their insurance, and they're ready to go. In reality, the shell company is supplying a much higher number of workers to multiple job sites working in conjunction with the contractors. The actual site contractor will write a check to the shell company holder in the name of the shell, so it's all done in the name of this business entity. Shell company holder will cash the check at a check cashing store, pays workers in cash. As long as the shell company holder can maintain that business entity status, they're able to avoid workers' compensation premiums, employment, and income taxes. It's a huge tax fraud that really hits a lot of different areas at the state level. Another thing that's interesting about this example is it's a great example of how lack of ability to information share between state agencies will facilitate the fraud. In most of these examples, you will have a shell company holder who's been operating under a single business name, and so that information is with all the different state agencies, including the Department of Revenue for tax purposes. The contractors are 1099-ing this company. At some point, the Department of Revenue says, hey, this company owes us a lot of money. And as soon as they start asking questions, the shell company holder will just essentially drop the shell company and will, very shortly thereafter, go and register a new business, sometimes even in their same name, because they know they do not have to be concerned about the fact that the Department of Revenue is talking to the Secretary of State's office or any other entities, because our income tax and all our tax disclosure laws are so strict in Oregon, and the business registration laws are at the other end of the spectrum. They can just continually drop business entities. I've talked to others and said, you know, drug dealers use cell phones. The cell phone is the mechanism by which they do a lot of their deals, and when things get a little too hot or they think someone's paying attention to the cell phone, they drop it and get a new one. These individuals are doing the same thing with business entities. When things get a little hot with that particular business entity, they just drop it and pick up a new one. I imagine the next year we will have some specific information to talk about in terms of what's happening in Oregon in this front. The next couple examples are just specific cases where straw owner issues came into play, and these are cases where the tax evasion or the loss to the state is not the primary issue. This is consumer fraud and taking advantage of consumers utilizing the system. Also, these following examples are ones that were investigated and worked by the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection Unit at Department of Justice. We work with them pretty closely to try and make sure we have an understanding of the overlap between our cases. Public Heating and Home Improvement, and this was a company that preyed on vulnerable seniors by offering free inspections of their heating systems. As you can imagine, if there was a small defect found, they used high pressure tactics to try and sell the repairs. If everything seemed to be in order, they were known to actually cause problems, maybe puncture a water line, do something else, and again, leave cards around and ask people to call. In this case, the registered agent turned out to be a straw owner who was paid $200 a month to serve in that capacity by the folks who were really behind the business. Again, they just identified someone they were willing to pay to do that, and determining who's really behind the business becomes very difficult at that point. Aristocrat Auto Wholesale, this is a good example of someone who got in trouble with California's licensing and so decided to come up to Oregon to use Oregon's licensing system to get around that. This company was a used car dealer in California. California suspended their California's license and their bond. The real owner down in California used a straw owner in Medford and mail drops in that town to obtain their Oregon business registration. And again, once you have the Oregon business registration, that opens the doors to other licenses. Once that was done, he applied for a dealer license and a bond using the Oregon registered business name. The dealer application to Oregon DMV was submitted under false pretenses. The dealer never intended to operate in Oregon. And again, this is a good example of that first step in the process as the business license really opening the door to being able to do further business in the rest of the state. I think there is a belief among many agencies and many consumers in Oregon that if you have a business license, that is some kind of good housekeeping seal of approval. You know, I'm not sure that that's actually consistent with the function and the means for which we operate that system now, but I think that the belief is out there. The next area, and this is one that I have struggled with myself, where individuals and entities that have either been convicted criminally or where civil action has been taken against the business entity, and in cases where the business entity was specifically used to facilitate the fraud, even after the activity, and they get caught, they're able to go out and continually just open additional business registrations because there doesn't appear to be a solid mechanism for preventing that. The Sunrise Wholesale case, the two individuals that were the primaries in this case, we convicted them of racketeering as well for tax evasion. This was another case that was upwards of $500,000 in just tobacco tax evasion to the state. I indicted both the primaries and I indicted the corporation. That is something you're allowed to do under Oregon law, although it causes all sorts of difficulties at the local level because people aren't sure what to do with that type of indictment. These folks, again, were sentenced, were found guilty, and I was just doing a check the other day, and Juan Nguyen, the same individual, has since registered additional business names, and again, we've got a pattern of fraud and just violating the state laws and continue to be able to go back and do that. The next example is from our Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Unit. Lewis Wayne Thayer registered a number of businesses under variations of his name, which I have there. His scam was soliciting auto repair shops to get coupons placed in discount coupon books that he would then sell door-to-door. But, of course, sometimes he was selling coupons for businesses that didn't offer the service. Kind of hit or miss in the book. Consumer Protection Section investigated one of his businesses, which was First American Marketing Corporation, doing business as Community Car Service. After the court enjoined that business from operating in Oregon, Thayer then again registered another business name, American Sales Training Academy Incorporated, DBA Community Car Service, and apparently he has a whole list of other names he has since registered as well. Just recently, we talked to some people about difficulties that they found trying to get information behind what has been provided because the person registered online. This is a pretty stark example that deals with a company that was registered called Cycle Parts 2007. The registered agent and registrant was a Joe Matthews, spelled with one T. The DOJ civil unit was unable to find a Joe Matthews with one T in Oregon, but they were able to find a senior and a junior that had two T's, contacted both of those individuals. And as it turns out, Joe Matthews Jr. works for this company and had no idea that the owner, who again was trying to distance himself from the entity, had gone online and registered him as the registry agent and operator of this business. Were it not for financial fraud reaching out and making some contact, because Cycle Parts 2007 had been engaged in some fraud, this individual would not have known it. I know that the financial fraud section I listed here contacted the Secretary of State's office, and they could not get any background information that would help them in identifying who that individual was. I will say, as to the question earlier, in terms of can you track the payment, we have attempted to do that in a couple of our other cases, you know, based on the information that was presented at the office at the time of registration. Can we track it back? We even had a number of individuals where it's cash, so there's no mechanism even for figuring out where that money came from. Even if, as law enforcement, if we had a credit card or something, we'd have the ability to go a little bit deeper if we were trying to connect an actual person with the business. And in this local or this recent instance where the person had provided cash, we're fairly certain that the person that we're looking at as the actual owner is not the person that walked in and registered this business in their name, and it's just going to make it a little bit more difficult for us to make those connections as we go down the road. And then finally, something that shouldn't be surprising is that there are scammers out there who are operating and claiming they have a business license and that they are registered with the state of Oregon when they are not. Todd Grange was an internet scammer. He has a number of different websites here he operated. He signed an assurance of voluntary compliance with DOJ's civil unit back in 2007. He's violated. He has a number of judgments against him. He continues to use different business names, which he claims are registered with the state, but of course are not. And there's very little we can do about stopping someone who's out there operating business in that manner. So those are just a few examples of places where we have seen, again, I call them the soft spots in the business registration laws being exploited by people who want to cheat. Mr. Thrallco made the statement earlier that the system really relies on the integrity of the person who was filing it, and my sense is that the criminals in Oregon have figured that out and are exploiting that as best possible.
Thank you. I have one question for you. Yeah, I want to try to keep moving along, but when you have a case where a corporation and individual have, you know, lost their licenses in another state or been convicted of a felony in another state or even in this state, is it unconstitutional for us to prevent them from re-registering a corporation or getting another business license? I mean, can we just categorically say, you know, no, because of your record, we're not going to issue you another license to do business in the state of Oregon?
Chair Holvey, I would hate to comment on the constitutionality or unconstitutionality of that without doing some research. But I do know for purposes not just of business licenses, my experience has been primarily working with the Department of Revenue as they issue tobacco distributors and wholesalers licenses. My understanding, it comes down to what is in the regulations at the time the regulation is written. Just like if you're getting a liquor license or a lottery license in this state, if you are a convicted felon, there are prohibitions against you being able to use the good name of the state as you continue to do your business.
Thank you. Any other quick questions? Representative Gilliam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For both of you, are you concerned today mainly because of the focus from a federal and national level, or because of increased activity in the state?
Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, the issues that have I guess been, you know, most addressed with us really are those that concern the folks at the national level. You know, we've there were a number of things that Donna talked about here that we participated in. We helped state police set up a business that was used in the tobacco case so that they could go out and conduct their investigation. We've worked with the Department of Justice in some other instances where we've done similar activity in helping them set up the business for their investigations. Primarily, I think the issues that have been addressed most to us are those that really look at the international. We're concerned. We're concerned on both levels. As we've looked at other issues, problems that we see in the business marketplace, we had a group out of California over the last year that we felt were conducting a pretty blatant scam on Oregon business owners, and they were sending out mailers to them and saying your business name is due for renewal, send us $100 and we'll renew it for you. Well, a month and a half later, we sent out our renewal that said it only cost you $50. And you know, we had a lot of Oregon business companies that just fell for that. And you know, as we worked with the Attorney General's office and one of the Senate committees, basically we found that Oregon Constitution prevents us from taking any action or passing any laws that would prohibit commercial free speech. So short of changing the Constitution in that particular area, we're pretty powerless to do anything but try to educate our customers and the public. And to that we were successful because the company finally did close down their operations earlier this year, and they've left, but we know who they are. We've seen them here 10, 12 years ago. Texas, Florida, many other states see them. They pop up and they come around time after time again. So we just have to be diligent and look out for folks like that, as well as cooperate with law enforcement and provide them the information and help them with research and look for opportunities that we can strengthen the law to help protect people.
Thank you. I'd really like to keep moving along here, but go ahead, Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Just a quick question, Mr. Chair. Operations that, where you describe what your business is and it turns out to be a porn operation or something like that, does anything ever prevent that individual from starting another business once he's shut down? I mean, do we have any protection against this continuing in various communities?
We don't have anything today. I'm actually only aware of one situation where an Oregon judge was prosecuting the case. I can't remember the name of the individual or the business, but it was somebody that was so egregious that the judge banned him from ever owning a business in Oregon again.
One case in the whole
history? One case ever, and that's the only time. But, you know, I wouldn't think there would be anything that would prevent him from saying, well, you know, hiring an employee and say, you go register the business in your name and we'll do this together.
Thank you. Mr. Representative Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Briefly, this is, again, at the numbers behind this intriguing and disturbing story here. Are there significant numbers of these businesses that do no business in Oregon that are registered here, that have no office, no employees, and do no business here?
Chair Holvey, Representative Harker. I wasn't able to get to run a new report, and even the reports that we run, I mean, you know, people don't register with us in that manner. So we have to do a little analysis, look at the filings, and look at those that really are coming from using a lot of overseas addresses. It's possible that they could get around that by hiring someone in Oregon to use list your address. But the last time we ran the numbers, it was something in the range of about 5,000 companies that listed or used addresses in what we consider to be the offshore tax havens. We have a list of about 20 or 30 countries. I would say that's out of 380,000 registered businesses.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate you exploring this issue with us as it came to me last session through looking at some of the workers' comp and construction industry issues as well as some of the banking issues, and then come to find out the Coast Guard had intercepted I can't remember whether it was a Liberian freighter out in the middle of the Pacific, and found out that it was registered to an LLC in Oregon, and they couldn't find out who owned it, so they couldn't really pursue any kind of legal efforts in trying to curb their activities, which were illegal, but as well as some banking issues as well that Mr. Tatman knows of. But I appreciate your bringing this forward, and I hope to continue to work with you, seeing what we can do in the state of Oregon to at least try to help curb some of the abuses of our business entity registration system with that, and hope I can continue working with you as we enter in the 2009 session. But I'd like to bring up some gentlemen who've been patiently waiting. I'm not sure if it's gentlemen or gentlemen who will be coming up, but we have some representatives from the FBI from the Portland Division who I've also had discussions with on this issue, and they could probably shed some light on this issue as from the federal perspective, and why Oregon seems to be important in this discussion in their minds. Thank you. You would introduce yourself for the record, too. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Chairman Holby and members of the committee, my name is Alan Peters. I'm Assistant Special Agent in Charge of the Portland Division of the FBI. My territory encompasses the entire state of Oregon. Also, I have with me my supervisor over the white-collar crime within the state of Oregon, Joe Boyer, a longtime resident, also an investigator here in Oregon, and one of my lead investigators, who is really one of the global experts in this particular matter, not only here within the state, but throughout the country, Kurt Rono, extensively investigated these shell company issues. Again, we want to thank you for your invitation to speak in front of you this day. Now, the testimony that we'll provide does not reflect FBI's position on any pending proposal for legislation, of course, addressing the formation of shell corporations. The FBI is also prohibited from disclosing information regarding pending investigations, so you'll see that we will skirt that for obvious reasons, but we want to be free in discussing some of our concerns regarding shell corporations, registered agents, especially within the state, and some of the difficulties we're finding in our own investigations because of the structure of incorporating within the state as it currently stands. Some of the comments that we'd like to provide, though brief, they're information that's already been disseminated throughout the country through and by law enforcement administrative agencies concerning this particular issue. You've got the testimony in front of you here, and I don't want to go verbatim. I want to hit a couple of the key points that we think are germane, and then field some of your questions. We think that might be most appropriate, unless you prefer, Chair, to have me read it verbatim.
I prefer the first option.
I thought you might. In brief, and just going down some of the key points in here on the first page, I think the last line is germane. It says, in this day and age, except for the most local of cases, the categories of domestic or foreign law enforcement cases are almost archaic. virtually, and we found this truly to be the case globally with the FBI, virtually every major domestic investigation involving an organized criminal group has an international dimension, and many major foreign cases, if nothing else, involve the transfer of funds to the U.S. financial system. That's a huge statement. Moving on, clearly we have a global effort to address international crimes. Global, we have representatives of the FBI, for example, in legal attachés, known as legats, in embassies throughout the world, literally to be the conduits of for law enforcement here in the United States, representing the United States and dealing with countries outside of the country, or dealing with these foreign entities as the conduit, as the go-between to assist them and assist us here in the States with dealing with the international frauds, international schemes, and terrorist activities. It's difficult, and there's some difficulties that we're actually facing at home. It's difficult enough abroad, but the difficulties at home will be accentuated in some of the testimony here. Moving down to about the middle of the page in here, over the past several years, we have seen numerous cases where domestic shell corporations have been established to facilitate foreign criminal activity. Several of these cases have involved activity designed to move money outside of Russia, either to evade Russian taxes or else to facilitate organized crime schemes. And this statement reaches a broad range of hidden international entities, not strictly centered solely on Russia. Criminals who establish shell corporations in the United States are now increasingly opening bank accounts for those corporations in offshore jurisdictions where customer identification requirements may be less rigorous. However, these corporations are still able to gain access to the U.S. financial system if the foreign bank has a correspondent account at a U.S. financial institution. Moving on to registered agents and intermediaries. Thus, now the criminals establish U.S. shell corporations in the name of nominees and through intermediaries, through registered agents. The criminals then establish bank accounts in the name of the U.S. shell companies in foreign jurisdictions. Latvia remains a popular jurisdiction for opening such bank accounts, but other jurisdictions are used as well. Moving on to the bottom of the page, we as U.S. law enforcement agencies cannot determine who is perpetrating the scheme by reviewing the records maintained by the state where the shell company was formed, because the criminals use nominees on the paperwork and purchase shell company via an intermediary, via a registered agent. Law enforcement also cannot determine who is perpetrating the scheme by reviewing the U.S. bank account records directly, and I think we've already had some testimony by Ms. Maddox related to some of the concerns about trying to follow the money and the bank accounts directly. And I think it was mentioned earlier, or discussed earlier, that following the actual payments for a corporation clearly is not a path to determine the ultimate ownership of those corporations. Moving on to the next page, a couple of specific examples of individuals that we've had a chance to deal with that have given us some background regarding this particular problem. At the top of the page, another factor that contributes to the frustration of law enforcement when investigating shell corporations is the use of company formation agents, as we talked about. The agents rarely collect information on ownership since the states do not require it. States generally do not require the agents to verify the information collected from clients. Some of the company formation agents open thousands of corporations and market these corporations around the world. In response to an incoming request for assistance in a foreign investigation, one registered agent told U.S. authorities that he estimated that he opened more than 8,000 companies for a foreign company broker over a 10-year period, primarily in Delaware and Oregon, without meeting anyone personally or having any knowledge about the business purposes for those entities. During an interview of a registered agent for an Oregon company involved in a suspicious wire transactions, the third-party agent outlined his involvement in registering companies. He noted, basically, he advertises his status as a third-party agent on the Internet and responds to requests from overseas to register companies in the United States. The agent receives $80 for every corporation he establishes. Over the course of several years in that business, This again in Oregon. The agent registered over 2,000 corporations, over 1,200 of which were still active companies at the time of an interview recently. The registrations took place mostly in Oregon, but also some additional states as listed in the testimony. Most of the requests to the third-party agent for incorporating businesses in the United States involved Eastern Europeans. According to the agent, Oregon maintains some of the lowest costs for forming corporations and incentive, and Oregon law requires very minimal information when forming corporations. Also, once he completes the paperwork and finds and forwards the information to the requesting party, he no longer has a part in that business. Now, we would note that to date, it appears the vast majority of registered agents are operating within the confines of the law. This is to say their activity does not appear to be linked to criminal activity that gives rise to suspicious transfers, nor do they have knowledge of details of particular schemes in which the shell companies are utilized. In essence, they provide the vehicle to move criminal proceeds around the world in order to conceal the source of those funds or promote additional criminal activity. In that last paragraph, one of the most significant frustrations facing us as law enforcement is the inability to identify beneficial owners of these companies. That is critical. In many cases, investigations have been closed, notwithstanding the identification of suspicious wire transfers through the U.S. financial institutions and or potential criminal activity linked to those wire transfers because of the inability to identify owners of the shell companies. We discussed a situation with the guard just a second ago. There have been successful investigations, but only through joint investigative efforts with our own foreign law enforcement partners through these connections, through our legal attachés. In those cases, foreign law enforcement agencies have been able to identify the owners of the U.S. companies through the bank accounts held in the company names located in those foreign banks. But as I know you're all aware, that is difficult, and many of the countries, quite frankly, have no interest in allowing us to have that information to continue our investigations. You've had the benefit today of hearing from the state government who are testifying on the impact of these shell corporations in the state. And I'm hopeful that some of the testimony and some of the questions that we may field to you may be able to give you some insight into the global significance and the global frustrations that we're facing in law enforcement, especially on the federal side, and many of the cases that the state investigates, we are investigating jointly because of some of the inability we have to be able to identify who truly is behind these shell corporations.
Thank you. I appreciate you bringing this forward and your willingness to at least shed some light on this. It is disturbing to me, as it was a year and a half ago, to find out that Oregon is, you know, one of the top problems in the nation for law enforcement at the federal level, being able to investigate and actually prosecute criminals around the country and organized crime throughout the world. And having said that, my interest in this is, I suppose, moving Oregon towards a state which requires the kinds of information that will help prevent the abuse of our system. I'm sure if most Oregonians knew what was going on with business shell companies that are registered in Oregon, they'd be appalled by it. Certainly I am, and I appreciate any suggestions you might have as to what we can do in contacting the Secretary of State's office, which I know you've worked with already. About what we can do with our statutes and our laws in regards to identifying who owns the companies and being able to track what their activities are a little bit better than we do, so that that information can be used both by our state attorney general as well as your agency as well. With that, I'm gonna open it up for any questions. Representative Riley.
Just very briefly, it sounds as if we're one of the top two in the country of the hard to track. What I wanted to know is what are some of the states that have the laws that you like the best in this area?
That's a good question, and actually that's a question that we unfortunately, Representative Riley, would not be able to address. We are not at liberty to discuss any existing legislation and our sense of that legislation and how it fits in to provide any
That's an adequate
direction
answer,
one way or the other, that we feel one's best or the other. It gets us into the political realm, which we try to avoid. But I will tell you, in summary, though, the key element for us as investigators on the federal side is knowledge is power, clearly. And the more knowledge that we have, the more opportunity we have to have a clearer picture of those corporations that we consider to be suspect that we have on our radar screen for investigation regarding their backgrounds, regarding who they actually are. Clear that knowledge is power for us. So the opportunities to be able to have more information, anything along that line, clearly is going to be of value to us.
Thank you.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In a previous testimony from the Justice Department, we had several examples, and the one that kind of struck me was this Joe Matthews example. And in the testimony here, it says, you know, that this person supposedly was, his name was used by a former owner. And then it says there's nothing in the system that would prevent this from happening. From your standpoint as a, you know, an investigator, what could we do just practically without legislation to cooperate with the Secretary of State, with the Department of Justice, and with you from the federal level, the State Department of Justice, and with you at the federal level, to check that? Isn't there technology, isn't there a process where you could easily check if someone is using a false or misusing someone's actual name? Just to cross-reference every time somebody registers a business name at the Secretary of State in Oregon?
That's a very good question. And the short answer is there's no central database or singular way to do this name check. The circumstance you're talking about here clearly is a form of identity theft, where that name is being used for purposes that's not directed by that individual. And that would be an example of something that may be prosecuted by either federal or state statute. But as far as doing the background, being able to clearly articulate or to determine that a particular name is being used without someone's knowledge or is a false name, well, it's a difficult one because you're going to deal with offshore individuals anyway, where we don't have that information at our disposal. And second, the whole concept of identity theft is to use somebody's real name and information without their knowledge. So the check would come back maybe in this particular, similar to this particular instance, with a valid individual. That individual may not know that name's being used for that particular purpose. And absent making a call for every corporation that gets established and checking the background of that individual, it'd be very difficult to have a one key punch to make that assessment. But it's a good question. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. I Representative Nelson, a question?
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you for being here. You scare me. I'm concerned about our state, but isn't there some trigger about this $10,000 deposit? But do you work with IRS? I mean, isn't there something that every individual who makes a $10,000 more deposit, doesn't that trigger some alert?
Absolutely.
And so can't we get a heads up there to check out who's behind those monies?
As a matter of fact, ma'am, you're absolutely right. That is ongoing with the banking system, where the banks are required to notify regarding significant deposits. The problem is, and that's really one of the purposes for these crimes, for these corporations to be established, so they can run this money through. And even if the money's being run through and it cannot be determined that's being used for nefarious purposes. There's no laws in place to say just because there's a lot of money going through there that they're in violation of anything in anything specifically. One of our objectives in the investigations is to determine what's on the other side of that money. Money that may be flowing through corporations that may be formed, for example, in the state of Oregon. Who's on the other side of that money and where that money originated? Until we get to that point in the equation, we really don't have an opportunity to really sink our teeth into a significant criminal investigation. The IRS does take a look at these transactions and the money flow, but again, the purpose of the proceeds, the use of the proceeds, the origination of the proceeds is the critical element for us. And in fact, when we're dealing with money laundering issues in here, we're dealing with accounts where the money is originating from overseas. In some of the instances that we're dealing with in here, we're going back to the purpose of our discussion here with the shell corporations. Without having a basis on our end of knowing who the originator of the corporation is, as the money flows overseas, it really puts us into a bit of a trap as far as going much further in the investigation. Again, without going back to the originating company or originating country, and as you all well know, finding that we're getting stonewalled because many of those countries quite simply don't have an active interest in exploring that because it's a financial boon to them. Agent Boyer, you've got something to add, I think, on that particular topic.
Thank you, Chairman Hovey and committee. I'm Joe Boyer. And the only thing I was going to add on that is there is a requirement to report cash transactions to CTR for $10,000. That's not really the issue we're dealing with in this situation. We're primarily dealing with people who've really never been in this country who are going through registered agents, setting up the shell corporations, and then establishing bank accounts overseas. And so it's not a matter of cash moving here. It's a matter of money moving overseas and the inability to figure out who's moving that money and why.
Circular.
Just
yes.
A quick follow-up then, please.
Follow-up.
So my concern is this, for example, the money coming from Russia to the U.S. Do we have any, requirement from financial institutions here assisting in wire transfers? And did you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do understand what you're saying. And as far as wire transfers, we can certainly, it's easy to trace money leaving the country. It's easy to trace money coming into the country. The problem is getting to the origin of it. If they go through correspondent banks, they're use what's called intermediaries, where all you really get is the beneficiary bank information. You don't get the account holder. You don't get the rest of the information. So you can see it coming and going, but you can't get beyond that, particularly when the account holders are unknown to us and they're not the ones. We don't know whether or not they're the ones who actually went through the registered agent to set up the companies, because there's no requirement that their identity be disclosed.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your willingness to spend your time and trying to give us the perspective from the FBI on this this issue, which is, you know, a concern for us in doing business inside the state of Oregon, but also very disturbing to find out that Oregon's being used overseas as a vehicle to do illegal activities. And I'm hopeful that we'll be able to change some of our business identity information requirements to curb some of that, and certainly look forward to the NACUSL recommendations that come out as well, and hopefully we'll be able to incorporate those recommendations in, and certainly appreciate your time. So with that, I'm going to, if anybody else has any questions of this, I just wanted to, you know, bring this subject back up so the committee was at least familiar with this as I ran across it in looking at some consumer issues inside the state of Oregon, and then looking at some of the other things I found out about, it just sort of grew to this much, much bigger issue than originally I started out on, and I think it bears this legislature to pay attention to business identities in the state of Oregon. So thank you very much.
And can I just ask one quick question, please?
Thank you very much. I know it's going to be a quick one.
It will be. Here's an example that I know happens frequently because of no sales tax here. You know, different individuals use our state for that purpose of vehicles or other huge purchases. I mean, how do we track that? I mean, if a business is in the business of doing that, how do we curtail that?
I think you've got, ma'am, I think you've got the origin, your Oregon DOJ is already looking into that very matter.
Oh, good.
That might be something you might want to bring up to them. Oh. And in addition, as we mentioned earlier at the beginning, clearly we feel there's a concern for us to have more information because there are entities that we are investigating as we speak. As we reach resolution to the point where we are able to discuss them to a further degree, we'd be glad to come back and give you some more insight as far as some specific examples as we're able to do so. Good question.
I appreciate that offer and recognize the lack of ability for you to really discuss things fully as they may impair your investigations or tactics or whatever. So I just appreciate you just letting us know that it's an issue for you, what we do here in the state of Oregon. So, again, thank you very much. And with that, committee members, I think we're scheduled for one more meeting before the end of the year. I don't know if we have a date yet.
No, Mr. Chair, actually, I ran out of time to send out an email to committee members, but okay. I will send one out this afternoon.
It will
be in early December.
December 4th?
November 4th. Late in the afternoon.
It'll be early
after
December.
Thanksgiving.
Early December. So where we'll probably be entertaining some legislative concepts for 2009 for committee bills. And so with that, thank you very much for your attention. And I adjourn the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection.